a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
We're going to call this meeting of the Executive Board Monday, June 27th, 2011. To order, I want to welcome everyone listening to us on the Internet, those of you that are here in the audience today, and I want to welcome back all the members of the Executive Board. I want to thank you for being patient and working with me over the last couple of weeks. We made a couple of adjustments to the time and agenda, which I thought was appropriate in light of the flooding and everything else that was going on. So I want to thank you for working with us. And that, with that, we'll get into the board meeting. If the secretary would please call the roll.
Senators Gray, Hunstead, Maher, here. Nelson,
here.
Tiedemann,
here.
Thiessen,
here.
Representatives Abdullah,
here.
Carson,
here.
Townsend,
here.
Feinstein,
here.
Lucas,
here.
Rausch,
here.
Benner,
here.
Cutler, and Chair Turkeville,
here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you. You've all received a copy of the minutes of the previous meeting. Are there any questions, comments? If not, I'd like a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
I have a motion, a second to approve the minutes of the meeting. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion carried. All right, we're going to get into the first item on the agenda, report of the Investment Council Subcommittee. Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we do that, did we want to approve the agenda and make any additions to the agenda?
If you would like to make that a motion, we will.
I would like to make one addition to the agenda, and that's to bring forward to the Executive Board the issue regarding the payment to the Midwestern Higher Education Compact.
All right.
And then with that, I would move the agenda as amended forward.
Is there a second? Second by Representative Rausch. Any further comments or questions? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Thank you, Senator. All right. Now we will get into the report on the Investment Council Subcommittee. And with that, Senator, are you going to do the personnel report? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Investment Council Subcommittee met this morning with Chairman Havenstuck, and just wanted to bring forward that this is Chairman Stuck's last formal meeting before the Executive Board. And before we turn him loose to give the report, sharing that spotlight with our investment officer, I would like to just move that the Executive Board recognize Chairman Stuck for the years of service that he has done for the Investment Council, and want to thank him for his diligence to the job, the bringing the creative ideas to it during the good times as well as the bad times, and just also say, you know, thank you for doing this as a volunteer.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you, sir. And we do appreciate the time that you spent on there. The Investment Board has done wonders for the state of South Dakota. And, of course, we have to give some credit, plenty of credit, to you and the other members of the board. So thank you, and you will be missed.
Thanks.
We have a motion. And a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion carried. Thank you. All right, at this time, we're in line to hear from the Investment Council Personnel Report. If you'd please proceed.
We're going to hand out a little information for everybody, the information we went over with the subcommittee this morning. While Matt is handing that out, Matt Clark is handing that out. He's the Chief Investment Officer. A couple other members of the council are with me today. Rob Wiley is behind me, and also Jared Johnson, both serving on the investment counsel by virtue of the position that they hold. We've got this organized today, a front page there, which just gives a recap of some of the things that we want to discuss here. And we can kind of spend as much time or as little time as people want on this. I'm going to go through outlining several things, as well as Matt discussing the trust funds in particular. But if there's anybody has any questions, please break in and interrupt us and ask the question. The front page just gives us an outline of where we're going to go, the assets managed, the council's role, how we have set up our compensation plan for the investment office, the investment officer's compensation, and then we wanted to mention the 529 scholarship program, and it's on the front page here, and there's not another page that addresses that. That's some monies that we get. There's almost $1 billion now in the 529 program, South Dakota 529 program, and we receive 10 basis points or 0.1% of that amount from the manager, and that amounts to nearly $1 million a year now to go into the scholarship program, the Dakota Core Scholarship Program. And I know there's going to be some other discussion on that program later on, but that's the involvement that the investment office has with the 529 program. The page two shows the a big picture of the assets under management, and this is what the investment council manages. As you can see, there's a breakdown of seven different funds that make up the total fund. Also, the total fund now, we're just shy of $10 billion, which is approximately the same as we had at the end of fiscal year 07. And that is, again, that's a March 31, 1911 estimate. The actual to date up through the 24th of June is approximately the same. So we would hope that will carry through here to the end of this fiscal year, and that we will be up about 22%, as indicated on page one. 22% for the fiscal year ending this coming Thursday, if the markets are relatively stable this week. The trust funds estimates are a little bit less than that, mainly because the trust funds have aren't managed quite as aggressively, although we're moving to that position, a little more aggressive with the trust funds to make them more in line with the investment policy that we have for the South Dakota retirement system. Again, looking at page two, shows the monies that we have under management and the breakdown amongst the various funds that make up that total of approximately $10 billion. Page three are the four particular trust funds, and I'll kind of let Matt go through each of those and discuss the calculations of each of the four trust funds that are set out here on page three of the handout.
Each of the four trust funds are shown: Healthcare, Education Trust, Dakota Cement Trust, and School and Public Lands. For the top three, for each, we show the principal value. For the Healthcare Trust, for example, that's around $85 million currently. We then show what that inflation would have grown to if it had kept up with inflation since the time that it was put in the fund. And so the healthcare trust fund, in order for us to be able to say we've kept up with inflation, we should have $106 million in there. In actuality, we have $102.4 million after a $3.8 million payout that's about to happen. It'll happen on July 1st, and we've already taken that payout out of all these numbers. Basically, before the payout, we're roughly keeping up with inflation. We're well ahead of the principal. The official principal number of $85 million is the one that we need to be above in order for you to get your 4% payout. And so the good news is we're well ahead of that now, so we can afford a setback in the markets. We're roughly $1 million ahead of principal after the payout. And so that's good, because a couple years ago we were behind principal, and then we finally caught up and have made a couple of payouts now and are nicely ahead because of the rebound in the markets. The return for the year, as Haven indicated, around 19%. This is well ahead of our long-term expectations, so I wouldn't get too used to double-digit returns. You know, if we have some big losses mixed in, then you'll have a lot of double-digit returns. But on average, we think we're going to earn about 6.4% long-term, based on the long-term return of stocks of being around 7.5% or so, and bonds being, you know, 4% or less, and then some for real estate and other things. When you add it all up, it gets you 6.4%. And if we're lucky and move in and out of stuff just right, you know, over time in the future, maybe we can add something to that, which is what we try to do. But so that's the healthcare trust fund. The education trust fund, the principal is $329 million. The fair value, that's the market value of the fund, is $370 million after the $14-some million payout that's going to happen on July 1st. We're behind principal, as you can see. We would need to be up to $409 million to have kept up, or with inflation, I mean. And so we're a ways behind that. But we're $41 million ahead of the official principal. So that's a lot of cushion in case the markets go backwards to help you still have a payout next year if things are a little bit weak. So that's good. But we're not keeping up with inflation yet. We need some more good markets to do that. We earned 19.2% so far this fiscal year. That's about to end in 3 days. In this fund, it's less than the other because of the tax-exempt bonds that we have to hold in the education trust fund. Some of the money that went into that fund originally came from the tobacco securitization proceeds, and some of those were tax-exempt bonds. And the Internal Revenue Service requires that if you issue tax-exempt debt and reinvest the proceeds, you've got to reinvest back into other tax-exempt debts. Otherwise, they call it a tax arbitrage, and they tax you 100% on the difference. And so that's why the return's less. We would have some bonds anyway, so we don't really have more in tax-exempt bonds than we would hold of bonds otherwise anyway. But we're holding tax-exempt bonds instead of taxable bonds, which pay a higher interest rate. And so that's what hurts us. Dakota Cement Trust, $238 million was put into that fund originally. And then they took $12 million out right away to make the payout. So we started to invest $226 million. But the official principal is still the $238. And we're right around there. We just paid the $12 million distribution. Each year, if the state has plenty of money in the cash accounts, then they usually take that money out on June 30th. And if the cash balances on the timing of income coming in to the state in general and disbursements is a little tight, then the BFM will ask us for the money early, which they can do. Last year they asked for it quite early, and this year just a little early. So we just paid it on the $12 million on June 15th. And that fund has earned actually the highest, 19.9%. When the money comes in and out and things like that cause slight differences in the amount that's invested in these funds. And so that causes modest differences in the returns. We need to be above $240 million in this fund in order for the 5% formula to result in more than $12 million. If we get over $240 million, then 5% of that will be over $12 million, and the difference above $12 million will be your extra payout that you can have for education purposes. But it's not just the ending market value. It's got to be an averaging that goes up. So it may take a year or two of being above 240, but the good news is we're right on the cusp of 240 now. So if we can move above and stay there for a while, then the extra disbursements from that fund will be allowed to resume. So that's good news because we had fallen way below principal during the financial crisis, and now we're all the way back and have basically even made up the original $12 million that was taken out right at the outset, plus paid all those $12 million distributions every year and the little bit extra that happened a few of the years. And then School and Public Lands Fund, that fund's earning a return kind of in the mainstream of these other funds, 19.5% fiscal year to date. And it's up to $181 million, which is virtually back up to the peak level that that fund was prior to the crash. And those of you that remember the constitutional amendment in 2000, the fund was only worth about $130 million back when the new investment processes were put in place. So we're up to $181 million now, $50 million ahead of where we would have been under the old procedures of just spending all the income and having it all in bonds so the fund could never grow. And so that's good news. The bad news is part of the reason that fund grows is because we have to hold back from the income distributions an amount to offset inflation. Now, there's an escape from that. If we have buy stocks and have them go up, for example, and then sell them, we can harvest gains. That would be called realized capital gains. And we're allowed to use those to offset the inflation holdback from income. And in the good years, we did that so that they got all the dividends and interest income and land rent that this fund generated could be paid out. And then during the crisis, all our gains went away and we had losses. We built up $10, $15 million worth of losses, and we had to make those up before we would ever have any gains to use to offset inflation. But it didn't hurt us because inflation was zero. Inflation actually went negative when gas prices plunged during the crisis and commodity prices plunged. And so we had no inflation for a year or so. And then we had a negative carryover that helped us offset the inflation we had last year. Well, now inflation's been surging. And for the 11 months through the end of May, inflation was at an annualized rate of roughly 4% for the 12 months to end on June 30th. And so we would have to hold back 4% of the value of that fund from the income distribution, and that would destroy most of the payout. It wouldn't destroy it in the sense that it would be gone. It would stay in the fund and help the fund grow, but it wouldn't be able to be paid out. Fortunately, in the last 2-3 months, with the markets having rebounded, we were able to scour the portfolio for things that were at a profit and sell them enough to get out of the hole and make up all of the losses and an extra $4 million of profit. And so that allowed us to offset the majority, the larger half of that inflation amount, but it's still going to cause the payout to be less on that fund for this year, and then hopefully we'll have enough gains we can get back on track after that. And Jared Johnson and I, the School and Public Lands Commissioner, have addressed that issue with the school administrators. And that's the trust funds.
Any questions or comments on the trust fund report? Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question. You explained that dealing with the tax issue and the arbitrage, and that went a little fast. Could you, as a tax guy, I'd like to.
Yes. The money that went into the Education Enhancement Trust Fund, most of that came from the securitization of the master settlement that the states had with the tobacco companies. When they sued the tobacco companies, and so the state issued, bonds against those future receipts in from the tobacco companies, and as it turned out, and we weren't involved in the securitization itself, although we did have a little bit of input and awareness of what was going on, they were able to sell taxable municipal securities against the early years revenues that were coming in from the tobacco companies, the more likely to happen ones. The further out in time, the more people were worried that the tobacco companies would go bankrupt, cigarette usage would drop off fast because of the higher taxes, and you wouldn't get the revenues. And because they were iffier, the underwriters determined that the market was best for those iffier cash flows in tax-exempt format. And so they chose to issue tax-exempt securities for those, against those far-out distributions, even though the yield was higher than on the taxables, ironically. But that spoke to the riskiness an iffiness of those later cash flows that they said that you actually couldn't get anyone to buy taxable municipals out that far against such iffy cash flows. Thus, they issued a mix of taxable and tax exempts. There was other money that we had already gotten directly from the tobacco companies that was available, and so the directly available monies and the proceeds of the taxable offering, which I think was higher than the taxables, that money was free for us to invest in stocks and bonds or in anything. And then the taxable part we had to reinvest back, or the tax exempt part we had to reinvest back into tax exempt municipal bonds, because the IRS says if you issue tax exempt securities and reinvest the proceeds, you have to reinvest back in to tax-exempt securities, or you're net creating additional tax-exempt securities, and they do not allow that anymore. They used to. People exploited that loophole, so they closed it, and they were going to institute a 100% tax on the profit that you made over and above. You know, if you earn more than the interest rate on your tax exempts, they taxed it 100%, even if you're a state government like us. So that means you're crazy to take any risk with that money then, since you know, tails you lose, heads the feds get it all.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that the South Dakota Cash Flow Fund is growing 11.4%. Are we holding a great deal of cash for somebody? What has changed that account?
Representative Carson, that money is a commingled fund of all the cash balances of all state agencies and affiliated things like higher education is in there. Even things like game, fish, and parks might have monies for buying land they may have gotten somewhere. The highway DOT may have a lot of grants for highway money, and when they get any of those entities get money, they have to put it in that cash flow fund. Or the colleges, when they issue bonds to build buildings, they have to give us that money, and we invest it until they make the disbursements. And so a lot of that money basically belongs to these other entities, and it's already been committed. We're just holding it until the bills are paid. Some of it is the state's money, the state's reserve funds, which I think used to be $130 million or something, and may be a little less now. That money is in there. All the state appropriations that you've made to all the state agencies, if the money is received from sales taxes or other things before the agencies spend the money, that amount's in there. And then you just have a lot of like conservation districts and things like that that might hold money in there for decades that just sits in there as almost like a trust fund that earns, you know, this low interest rate amount. That might be better served by being managed more like the trust funds, but it would take a constitutional amendment to strip those out. And so it's a whole mixture of those things. We don't see the details in our office of who that money belongs to, but BFM, and our budget analyst is our new budget analyst is sitting back there in the white shirt, and BFM has the breakdown, and they keep track of who each piece belongs to. And in the budget book, there's the cash flow fund is kind of broken out as all the cash balances.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, gentlemen, if you'd proceed, please.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next page. We'll kind of look at just an overview of what the role of the investment council is to select the investment officer. We're looking for a bottom line oriented, non-political environment. We established the investment policies, benchmarks, for example. Which benchmarks to use to gauge our employment, our asset appreciation, and the asset allocation guidelines. You can see a little bit of that back on the trust fund report, how we have established allocations and benchmarks for those different funds. In other words, how much we invest in stocks, how much in bonds, different types of bonds, private equity, commodities, in real estate. The investment council establishes those guidelines. We oversee the investment methodology and also have oversight over any external partners that we have. we have to monitor the compliance, and we do this through an audit, an annual audit, to make sure everything is done correctly, reporting requirements, transferring money, and all those are done in accordance with audit policy. We also have a conflict of interest policy to make sure that that's enforced. We also look at the annual budget and the long-term plan. And that goes to the executive board here for final approval. We have a compensation committee. We look at the compensation framework for not only the investment officer, but all of the staff people in the investment office. We recommend the investment officer's compensation to the executive board, and that's one of the main reasons we're here today. The importance of the council selection, and I must say that in my time on the council, I've been very impressed with this, with the time put in by the executive board to choose people to put on the investment council, and I think it's paid off. The selections, in my opinion, the people that I've served with have been outstanding. But we need people to, and just to kind of go through a few of the things that we in the council would look at or in the selection process. We need people that have the patience and discipline to carry out a long-term plan, and that's during good markets and bad markets. And we've experienced both over the last few years. We need to have council people that believe in a long-term approach and then have the discipline to live through that long-term approach, again during times where the market is up and times where the market is down. The legislature and the governor also need to exercise that same amount of patience and keep that long-term plan in mind. And I think that I would also compliment the legislature and the governor for having that patience and long-term perspective. The patience depends on the faith of a long-term strategy, and it depends on the capability of the investment team and the council. It's important to have people on the investment council that inspire the confidence not only of the other members on the council, but also with the investment team and with the legislature and the public.
If I could add a comment. Mm-hmm. If I could add a comment, I think I mentioned in the subcommittee that, you know, the gist of it is I think we hit a home run coming out of the financial crisis, and that would not have been possible without above expectations, absolutely perfect in my mind support from the legislature and the governor's office, you know, over the last 2-3 years as we went through, you know, rough periods. And everyone was completely behind sticking to our long-term investment strategy. And, you know, no one suggested that we should abandon it, you know, during the tough times. And everyone, you know, maintained that patience that we needed. And so my compliments to the entire legislature, the governor's office, and, you know, and council members that you've picked that were unparalleled compared to what my peers have to deal with across the country. I don't think any of them could say what I just said about any of those overseers that they have, and I can say it without any reservation about all three levels. So thank you very much.
The next couple pages of the handout talk about the compensation plan that the investment council has adopted, and it's a long-term plan. The purpose is to motivate superior investment performance, and most investment managers have a strong aversion to underperforming, and the trade shows that rewarding outperformance through incentive pay is a very valuable way to add value to the funds. We need the long-term focused incentives, and the incentives that they have for their salary include not only short-term incentives, one-year incentives, but also there's a benchmark against a four-year performance. So again, that long-term performance benchmarks lead to a method of implementing the long-term plan that's so important to the office and to the council's objectives. When we're outperforming, and this is the case in the last couple of years especially, the people that we have on the investment team are most attractive to other possibilities in the market. Mostly those would be private operations as opposed to government operations. So we need to make sure that the total compensation is that we offer to the investment team in South Dakota is somewhat at least comparable to that they could earn in other positions, other similar positions. And it's also important to make sure that those incentives are allocated in up markets as well as down markets. What we're really looking at is adding value. In other words, adding value to the fund more than the benchmarks that have been set. So even if there's a down market, if that the investment team has been able to earn more than those benchmarks, those incentives still come into play. Then looking at that, the next page, how we arrive at the compensation plan. So those are just kind of some of the basics. But we periodically commission a compensation study. Deloitte did it in 2006. We updated that in April of 2010. And what we're looking at is pay for similar positions in the industry. So we benchmark median total cash compensation. Now our target is 70% of the benchmark that Deloitte comes up with on a national basis. And we use the 70% or what is a 30% discount from those average compensation found by Deloitte in its study because it is a good deal for South Dakota. But also with the experience that we've had, we've been able to retain the investment people with, even though we have been paying them on a 30% discount to what the normal wages and income would be across the country and in private as well as government positions. That 30% discount, it comes after adjusting for cost of living. And the way that we set up the compensation is that there's a set salary, but there's also an incentive. And we set the set salary at approximately two-thirds of what that total would be. And then the incentive portion would add another 50% to bring it up to what we project to be the compensation for that individual. And that's, again, that's considering the 30% discount. Now, obviously, if they really perform well, they can earn more than their 50% incentive portion of their pay. But that takes outperformance not just for 1 year, but it takes outperformance over a number of years. The discount that, again, going back to the 30% discount that we've taken from the Deloitte compensation study, has increased somewhat here for during the past year since we implemented that study in April 2010. The studies have shown that that compensation in the industry has increased over that period of time, while the compensation at the South Dakota Investment Office has stayed stagnant or actually decreased slightly. Where we now anticipate that we're probably 40% below, and it's possible that we go into fiscal year 2012 could be as much as 45% below the benchmark set in the Deloitte compensation study. This is important for a couple reasons. The benchmarks, for one, are based upon a median, and if we look at the the performance of the South Dakota Investment Office, we're not in the median category. We're not only in the top quartile, but in the top 10% of similar funds. And when you get into the top 10%, the compensation is considerably higher. If we maintain these successes, then, of course, that makes, again, the people in our office more attractive to other people because of the good work that they have done. So that's important for us to remember that the compensation needs to track what they could earn otherwise. And it's important to maintain that long-term plan of increased compensation that we've implemented years ago and has been very successful for the investment office. We need top-caliber people to stay long-term. It's a tremendous investment to train investment people. And when we do get them trained, we want them to stay around. We've taken a 30% discount from the study in the past, and it has worked for us. There's nothing to say that couldn't be different from that, either less or more, but that has worked, and I think it's been a good deal for South Dakota, as well as being able to retain the people that we need. We just don't want that to get too far, to diverge too far from that 30%. Again, I think we have a good long-range plan, and it is worked successfully. And we've been able to retain the good people that we've had, which is extremely important. The internal costs of managing of the money at the South Dakota Investment Office is about 10 basis points, or about 0.1%. And those of you familiar with, say, mutual fund expenses, they can be easily 10 times that amount. So the internal cost of managing, mainly the compensation that we pay to the investment office people, is very small in compared to the funds that we manage. It's very small in comparison to expenses of other offices, other similar offices that manage similar amounts of money. But we need this long-term approach, and again, I want to compliment the executive board for being supportive of that long-term approach, as well as the governor's office being supportive of that long-term approach. I think it's really, as you go back to that page that we look at on the graph here, the second page, I think that shows that long-term approach is showed to be very successful, and we've bounced back in the last 2 years extremely well to where we're, I think we were number one among state funds a year ago, and we don't know where we're going to be at the end of this fiscal year, but if we're not number one, we're going to be very, very close to number one among all state-managed retirement funds. The last page of the handout is a motion that was made at our last council meeting. Basically, the council moved to recommend to this board a reduction of 5% for the fiscal 2012 base salary for the state investment officer, and to continue the investment performance incentive plan with any earned incentives for fiscal 2012. Investment performance be paid in early fiscal 2013 following completion of the audit, and, of course, subject to fiscal year 2013 budget authority.
I would like to continue this discussion, but we'd like to do an executive session. So if you would, please.
Chair,
yes.
I move that we go into executive session.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
At 10:30 p.m. Central Time. And repeat.
Welcome back into our regular session. Yeah. Depends on how you vote.
No, but how can we get out?
All right, the next item on our agenda is a report from Secretary Denny Kamek, who's with the Department of Corrections. We've asked him to come and briefly discuss with us any updates on corrective action that is taken, and also what legislative resources are needed. Now, because of the continuing investigation of the incident and because of the pending trials, we will not discuss the incident itself, and we will not take questions in regard to the incident. That, to my way of thinking, the briefing by the governor and his staff and all the news media, I think everyone here has a good idea of what happened. So we, once again, are only going to discuss the improvements that have been made and any issues that you feel the legislature may help you with. And so with that, gentlemen, welcome. Is your mic on, sir?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the Executive Board, we're pleased to be here this morning. I have along with me, of course, Doug Weber, the warden, and also Lori Feiler is with me, and she's going to discuss something right at the end as well. We have the after-incident action plan, and you have been furnished that before, and we just want to know if there are any questions that you have of either of us that we can provide you in looking at that after-action plan. Most of the issues have been implemented. I believe the only one that we are waiting for yet at this time is the additional cameras. And, of course, that takes a considerable amount of time to get all of the conduit and electrical run to the different places. But we are working on that. Are we still looking at August 15th?
Yes, sir. We will be done no later than August 15th.
Okay. And so that are the items that we had in front of us that have not been completed yet. That is the only one. Looking at the financial part of that as well, it seems like we are waiting for some honor guard uniforms and a walk-through metal detectors that aren't in place yet. Is that correct?
They are now, sir.
We've just
got those put
okay.
in.
And so those are done?
Yes, sir.
Questions that anybody would have in reference to those?
Questions or comments? Representative Abdallah.
Secretary, Mr. Secretary, where are the magnetometers located?
The what?
Metal detectors.
Oh. Metal, well, it's a magnetometer.
They're representative.
Please.
Mr. Chairman. They are located in all of our buildings now, Representative Abdullah, in the Prison Industries building itself, where there was one already. There's one there. There's one located in the East Hall wing, the West Hall wing. Then we go out to Jameson proper in units B and D, and then a trustee unit that sits on the prison property outside of Jameson itself.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Were you able to purchase those with through your budget?
Yes, sir, through year-end money that we had some access to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions or comments? Representative Roush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in general, without too many specifics, how is the overall feeling of the employees and just their overall condition? Are they coping, struggling? We getting? They need assistance, help. Was it provided? Some morale in general.
I think I could sum it up by saying this: that I am absolutely impressed with the outstanding work ethics and morale that I see on a day-to-day basis with the staff who work at the prison. Obviously, none of us had ever been through anything this traumatic in our lives. Certainly not in our careers. And to see how they rallied around each other and the prison itself to ensure that this important work that we do continues, and they're outstanding in that. A couple examples. Of course, I've never been through this, anything like this, and you know, the thought enters your mind. You try to prepare for every possible scenario that you can imagine, and one of them was staff, of course. What's going to happen to staff? Are they going to maybe decide this job isn't for them, or their spouses decide for them maybe this job isn't for them after a terrible incident like this? Or would morale tank and they just be in a horrible place for a period of time? None of those things happened, I'm pleased to report. I know of one person who left and on her resignation form indicated multiple things, but also that she didn't feel safe. So she left and resigned her position, one. I'm also would like to add that one of the other measures that we looked at, and I personally looked at, was the use of sick leave following the incident. And I was amazed that we set an all-time record low as far as usage of sick leave in the 2 weeks following the homicide. That tells me a lot of things, but I think most significantly what it indicates is that staff rallied around one another and rallied around the prison and rallied around each other and the inmates. We can't forget about the inmates in this ordeal. So I'm very pleased with where they're at. Now, are there staff still hurting? Absolutely. Do I talk to staff that are still hurting? Absolutely. Am I still affected by it? I sure am. So it's there, but there's help available. We have a tremendous group of volunteers who work for us, and community resources who have volunteered their time that allow us to access them, or I know who I can refer staff to if I'm aware of or someone indicates they're having issues and trouble dealing with this.
Follow up?
One thing I'd like to add to that is that I had talked to Warden Weber several weeks into it, and I had a concern that in the weeks following this incident that we would see guards writing up disciplinary on inmates go up, whether it was on the side of the inmate or of the guard. And I'm happy to report that that did not happen. So I think that shows the professionalism of our people as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to, I'd spent some time on different occasions at the institution down there at the prison doing some ministry work. And so I'm grateful to hear that one, those who need help have access to it, and that the morale is as good as it can be, and that they're working as a unit. It's very comforting to me, and I think would be to the family also, that the family still doing the work that the guard had done so well for so many years. So,
the guard.
Thank you, Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe this question being probably directed toward the warden. What is your turnover rate, and then what is the national average of turnover rate within the prison system?
When we look at the turnover rate, and it fluctuates, of course, almost on a monthly basis, but we're looking at about a 20% rate. Sometimes it's a few points higher, sometimes it's a few points lower. And it probably compares a little bit high to most systems. I think we would be in the bottom third maybe of the country. But I think what people lose sight of is that this is a very challenging occupation and job, and we do our best to screen folks coming in on the front side to ensure that they know exactly what they're getting themselves into. But we still hear from folks that have been around 6 months or a year or have tasted the occupation and have decided, I don't really want to do this, and that's okay. But I think as we get better on the front end, we're going to see that rate continue to decrease slightly over the years. But it's still higher than I would like it to be, but I accept it as part of the occupation, I think. And there are some, like I said, there's some states that are higher and a lot higher. There are others that are lower and much lower.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I had the opportunity to go to the prison for St. Dismas on a Thursday night after the incident that happened about a month ago. And it was unreal how the prisoners came forth and were embarrassed at what had happened to that individual. They had nothing but high marks to talk about Mr. Johnson as a guard. It was very awesome just to visit with them, and they came forward and just unreal, that the comments that they made, unsolicited. They didn't know who I was. I was just there as part of the religious ceremony. And, that again, I think it speaks very highly of the work that you've done, Warden, in keeping and maintaining the prison. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. further comments?
Yes. Mr. Chair, if I could have a moment just to respond briefly to Senator Tiedemann's remarks.
Please do.
I think people can very easily lose sight of the inmates in this whole ordeal. And the inmates, in my experience, has been 99% of them or even more have been very sympathetic, offering condolences, have been in contact with Officer Johnson's family on a regular basis. We've delivered literally hundreds of condolences on behalf of the inmates. The inmates themselves have generated a fundraiser that will happen in the next few weeks that we anticipate will generate between $3,500 and $4,000. At their request, I approved it to go into the memorial fund. So the inmates were shaken by this, and they are impacted by it. And that's been exactly my experience too, Senator Tiedemann, is they all offer nothing but their condolences. I think I have three individuals who were locked up for inappropriate statements following the homicide, three out of a population of over 1,250 in Sioux Falls, of the maximum and high medium security guys the state has. So I think that speaks a tremendous, I think it sends a tremendous message on how they were impacted by this as well.
Thank you, sir. Any further questions or comments? All right. And then now, if you would, please, anything that you feel that the legislature can do to help you?
Well, I believe we have a lot of the things in place, and we're going to definitely look at that for the next budget issue if we believe we need things. But we have taken care of the security issues that we had brought up with year-end money, because with the cutting of positions, we didn't hire back during that period of time, so we had enough money in order to take care of those issues at the end for the dollars and cents portion of it. So that was good. And I just would like to say that you can be rest assured that the penitentiary and all of our facilities, the warden and his people, continually look at security issues, and they're continually evaluating those all the time and figuring out what they can do better and how we can get it done. And I've just been very, very impressed with coming on board the last couple months with the quality of the individuals, the quality of the people in Department of Corrections, and it's just been a very, very rewarding experience.
Thank you. All right, anything else from the committee at this time? All right, gentlemen, Warden Weber, Secretary Kamen, I want to thank you very much for coming and appearing before the board today. And we also want to thank you for the job that you've been doing. We feel that the prison is in good hands, and we just want you to know that there's anything that the legislature can do to help you, please don't hesitate to ask.
I would like Lori Feiler to come up just for a minute and talk about the NIC technical assistance grant that was talked about to come in and make a review. So just for a couple minutes, if she could do that.
That'd be fine, Lori.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lori Feiler with the Department of Corrections. In the after incident report, when that was released, we had talked about that we were going to ask for short-term technical assistance through the National Institute of Corrections to review this incident and our response to it. And I just wanted to update the committee that indeed is underway. The National Institute of Corrections is an agency that's been around for a long time. They're in the United States Department of Justice. They're currently under the Federal Bureau of Prisons, but they are available for this kind of work really across the country when correctional systems experience major incidents like this. We have used NIC for a variety of things over the years, some relatively small issues, some larger issues like this. But we've been in contact with them. They indicate that we are going to be able to get the technical assistance. We're in process, which is the typical way of doing it, of looking at the folks. They give us a list of people that do this kind of evaluation work. And then as an agency, we can interview them and select the ones that it's going to work in terms of their skill set and their schedule and those sorts of things. We're looking at a review probably the end of the summer is when they would actually be on site for the review, and then they issue a report that they brief with us. So wanted the committee to be aware that process is ongoing. And as discussed back the first part of May and continuing on, what we're asking NIC to look at is just generally what's our response to this incident, looking at applicable policies and procedures? Are there some things that we can continue to improve and some things that we can continue to do better? Looking at a response to this, and then also looking at our training, our staff training. So those were the specific things that we had asked NIC to take a look at.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
All right, we have 10 minutes before we recess. I see some people in the audience that, is there anyone else that wishes to briefly speak in regard to this issue? All right. Well,
I would, if I could.
Please come forward. Would you like to speak from the chair where you're at, ma'am?
Really? You think things are all that wonderful right now at the penitentiary? Really?
Ma'am, please direct your comments to the board. I understand. Yes, I do. Obviously, they are working to try and do the best that they can. It's a very, very unfortunate issue. It's something that
you have to make the guards safe. You have to make sure that the guards.
That is correct.
Safe.
Yes.
Then that starts with you people. They need obviously raises. They can't run short-handed all of the time, and they do. No matter what he says, they do run short-handed all of the time. You have to make sure that this doesn't happen to another guard. You just can't. This is on all of your heads to make sure this doesn't happen again. And they continue to run short. They continue to lose guards every week, every day almost. There were 5 last week, I believe. You have to make sure that they can stay staffed. They're not staffed.
Yes, ma'am. And you know, we're sorry for your loss. And the purpose of these two gentlemen coming here today was to tell us as a legislature what else they need, because we agree with you. We need to keep.
Okay, they never once mentioned salary for the guards.
That, yes, ma'am. I understand. That is something that I'm sure will be an issue that will be taken up. We're the executive board. When the warden and the secretary prepare their budget, when they come to the appropriations committee at the right time, then those issues will be handled. But for right now, we understand what you're going through. We understand your feelings. And if this is something that they bring to us, it's something that we will definitely look at the appropriate time. Sir, did you wish to make a comment?
My son Matt was the other officer that got injured that day on this day after us. The numbers report you had earlier said you had to have adequate pay to keep qualified people for your trust funds or whatever. Doesn't that apply to the prison staff too? Adequate pay to keep them?
Yes.
It should be very important.
Yes, the pay will certainly be an issue that will be addressed at the next legislative session, and believe me, the legislature is open to suggestions, and we know that this is an issue with you, and it's certainly something that will.
Something an hour. National average is 18.
Yes, sir.
Well,
like I said, that's an issue for the appropriations committee, and of course the department, and. And we would hope that's something that will be considered.
Yeah. I guess, to get you guys in my perspective, my son could have been killed there. That's what they wanted. So imagine one of your own kids where my son was. Would you get a little pissed off too?
Yes.
Okay.
The classification.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
The classifications that they use for classifying the inmates. That was not brought up today. Why?
The classifications?
They classify them where they should be.
Oh, yes, I understand. I understand. Well, here again... Well, here again, ma'am, that's an issue for the department. And basically what we were asking today is to ensure that the system continues and that they have everything that they need at their disposal. I'm sure that this is something that will be considered by the department secretary and by the warden if they need to change the classifications so that some prisoners are housed in different areas, or if there are prisoners that are not allowed to work or whatever. All of these things are part of the after action report that the Department of Corrections is doing in conjunction with the governor's office and the legislature. That's a report that is an ongoing effort.
That needs to be, because that just barely skimmed over the problem.
I understand. And that is something I'm sure that they'll be looking at. Yes, sir.
Okay. Right now there's a lot of changes being made, correct? How come so many changes were needed? Why weren't those policies in place prior to this incident?
Well, here.
And another thing, inspections. If the Secretary of Corrections wants to inspect the prison, does he have to tell them a few days ahead of time I'm coming down to inspect, or can he just drop in?
I would guess that the secretary has the option to drop in at any time and make an inspection. Absolutely, and if he doesn't, I hope that he would request that.
There should never be only one officer with two animals like that killed him. That's a failed policy right there.
Yeah.
I don't blame the current Secretary of Corrections, because your current Adjutant General was the Secretary of Corrections.
Yes.
So these failed policies are probably on his shoulders.
Well, these we look at it from the standpoint that these are policies that are being improved on in hopes that this never happens again.
How come so many changes are needed? You know, where was the oversight or the...
Representative Abdullah.
I'd like to address that portion of what Mr. Freeberg's statement. How many? Why so many? Corrections were needed. I don't necessarily agree that all those corrections were needed. I mean, as a result of the unfortunate incident, but maybe those corrections and steps were taken to improve. Most of the time they're proactive, but there are times we've got to be reactive. I've got some suggestions here that was sent to me by somebody involved in the deal, and I would just like to... address them. It says better pay and retention. Anybody that knows me knows when I was with the Highway Patrol, that was my priority, to get the staff and the troopers more pay. But sometimes that's impossible. And sometimes the legislature can do it if the money is available. But to just to say more pay would have prevented that incident, I don't believe. I don't believe that at all. And then there's an address here of union. Better for the officers. I disagree with that. You put a union, anytime you got public safety involved and you got a union involved, you got problems. You got real problems. I'm not totally anti-union, but when you get union people in the position of public safety, and it's your job to guard that door, and something happens over here, a lot of times they won't do it because that's not in their job description. And thankfully, we don't have that in this state. And also, if you get unions, you anticipate a better salary. But the state can only do so much with the money we have. And if we get the better salaries, then we cut staff. And then who's endangered? the correctional officers. I'm in favor of paying the correctional officers as much as we can, but we have state employees too. All state employees have been 3 years without a raise. We can only do so much with the money we got. I'm not crying, my eyes leak. So the easy solution is to throw money at it, and that's not the solution.
But if you had more money, don't you think they'd be able to keep them staffed? Keep a
absolutely
even level of
absolutely
guards. There's just not enough.
Ma'am, I witnessed it with the highway patrol. We spend $50,000 on a training a trooper, and the minute he hit the street, if he proved himself, some other agency stole him. That's bad business. But we can only do what we can do. And this, it'd be nice if we just had a open checkbook to pay everybody. But that isn't the solution to this problem.
What is the solution to keep the employees then? What is the solution to keep the guards?
We got to keep trying to pay them, and we kind of give them benefits. But we can't do something we don't have the money to do.
So the guards, so you want to tell all the guards that you're not going to have the backup that you need?
The guard.
You're going to come up against these people?
The guard.
Then they aren't going to have backup?
We're always going to have animals. We're always going to have animals.
Okay.
The number of people to guard them.
All right.
I understand that completely. You know my background, so... I understand the situation, but there's only so much we can do.
Yeah.
Another one of my concerns, you know, how come those two guys had so damn much freedom inside the prison?
I can answer that, Mr. Chairman.
Pardon me?
I can answer that.
All right, please do.
There's federal case law that says you can only lock up prisoners so long.
100 hours a day, right?
Yes.
When they're out of the cell, should they have cops on?
Pardon me?
They should probably have cuffs on.
I'm not in that business, so I can't answer that question. But you understand what I'm saying, that 23 hours a day, and with a number of 1,200 or 1,200 or 1,300 inmates, that takes a lot of guards. And you can't run an institution by locking up all the violent prisoners. That would be nice if we could do that. There's only one prison in the United States that I know where that happens, and that's in Marion, Illinois, the federal penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. Even the federal penitentiaries around the country have violent offenders working in the institutions.
That was the main cause of Officer Johnson getting killed, was being no along with those who have too much freedom.
Well,
I'm going to be calling the governor again.
All right, and that's certainly is your prerogative. But first of all, we want to thank both of you, all four of you, coming today. You know, this is I know this is tough for you, and we appreciate it very much. We want to assure you that everything that can be done is being done, that this is something that the legislature does not take lightly. It's something that we'll be looking at over the next few months. And so, with that, once again, thank you all for having the courage to come. Very good. And with that, before we go into a recess for lunch, we are running behind schedule. So with the approval of the committee, according to our schedule, the director's report was supposed to have been next, but we have interviews, candidates to be interviewed, scheduled at 1:15. So with your permission, we will bypass the director's report. I'd like to have the board back here by 1 o'clock so we can start at 1:15, and we'll go directly into the interviews.
We'll also do
the Uniform Laws Commissioner after the interviews. All right? Thank you, and we'll be in recess until 1 o'clock. Call this meeting back to order as soon as I think we have the majority of the members present. At this time, for those of you who are listening on the internet, we are about to interview the candidates for the investment council. We have four. To all of you, prior to today, there was four subcommittees that interviewed a number of candidates, and we thought in the interest of time and in order to save some people from making a long drive, we have brought to you the four top candidates. And at this time, the first one that will be appearing before the board is Bryce Healy. Representative Consett, do you have a disclaimer?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do.
We should go into executive session before we do that.
We don't need to go into executive session. We will go into.
All right. Okay.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to be upfront with everybody here on the board, and I had spoken to the chair and several of the members before that the candidate that is going to be coming up to be interviewed, Bryce Healy, is a relative of mine. I did offer to step down from voting for the person in this position, but I was assured by everybody that they trusted in my capability of putting the best fit person into this position for the investment council that would ensure their future stability on the board. Thank you.
Representative Abdallah.
I'd like to assure Representative Consett that I won't hold it against him.
Thank you. I'm sure she feels much better now. Mr. Healy, if you would, please. We are your audience.
Thank you. It's usually my sister-in-law is not so gracious and does not actually claim me, so only when she's forced to the point, I guess. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you this afternoon. I think I'll just give a few minutes of background and then why I'm interested in serving the state of South Dakota in this position. Just for a point of background, I'm a central South Dakota farm ranch kid from Pukwana, where I still own and operate with my brother's ranch operation. Attended Chamberlain High School and then went on to SDSU to get my degree. And after completing my ag business degree, I took what some in my family thought was the worst career move I could. I became a director of equalization for Marshall County. It's not exactly a popularity contest when you enter into a position as that. But what it did allow me was the opportunity to really learn and understand the tax structure of South Dakota and how funding mechanisms work. After my time with Marshall County, I moved to Huron to work for the South Dakota Farmers Union as their membership and cooperative development director, which then led me to my introduction to Commissioner of School and Public Lands, Kurt Johnson, who he asked me to come on as his deputy in 96, which I did, and then served him for 6 years until running myself for office, serving one term until my board of directors asked me not to return, and then went to work for the South Dakota Education Association, which has been a wonderful move for me. Enjoy my work with the South Dakota Education Association, which brings me in front of you many times, as you've seen me as well. With that being said, that's one of the main reasons I'm interested in serving on the Investment Council once again, as I have for 4 years. I can certainly hit the ground running, know the process quite well, and have had the opportunity to work under the only two state investment officers they've had. I've served with Steve Myers and Matt. But South Dakota Education Association has 7,000 members, and of the retirees in the retirement system, the bulk of them are educators. And that gives me a strong desire to serve their interest and their needs for something that is very important and of issue and concern to them. And that's probably the prime reason why I would look to serve in this role once again, but also then would stress I believe out of the candidates that have been interviewed, I'm probably the only one that has served before and knows the process and how the system works well. With that, I want to thank you for your time this afternoon, and we'll try to answer any questions that you may have, if they're easy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Bryce, during the time you were deputy commissioner for 6 years working with Kurt Johnson, were you involved to any extent then with investment strategies through Kurt and the Investment Council?
Yeah, I'm was lax in not mentioning that. Yeah, my 6 years that I worked with Commissioner Johnson as the deputy, we were involved. And if you remember, actually, back to that time, there was a constitutional amendment that passed that Kurt Johnson worked with Arlene Hamm on, and we got passed to change the authority of who invested those funds with the School and Public Lands Office. At the time, Commissioner Johnson didn't think it was all that wise to have a politician being the investment officer for that $170 million. And so we, working with Arlene Hamm, got that passed. And so we transferred then the lending that we were doing in the investing, because there was more than just investing with School and Public Lands Office. We borrowed money to build things as well. So as we were moving out of that field, though, working to get them transferred over to the Investment Council, yes, spent a lot of time with Tammy Otten in her role and other staff. So I hope that answers your question. Representative Lucas.
Follow up? Any further questions? Any members? Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Healy, as they, you know, already have in a profession in the SDEA, how would you balance a decision that may be in conflict with what the investment office is going to be doing in the future?
How to balance a conflict between the South Dakota Education Association, are we speaking policy?
It could be policy. It could be futuristic policy that may have a negative impact upon the group that you represent. I mean,
well, I think I could thank you for clarification. I think that makes my answer much easier. If it's going to have a negative effect on the group of people that I represent, which I, as I state, is the majority of the retirees, I think I will fall on the side of protecting the retirees to make the right decision when it comes to a policy decision with the Investment Council.
Further questions? Hearing none. Mr. Ely, thank you so much for being here on time and very appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next candidate is James Means. Mr. Means had was scheduled to be here 2 weeks ago when we canceled the meeting and delayed it. So he is unavailable to be here, but I wanted to make sure that he had an opportunity to speak to the committee and answer any questions if there are. So if we will just stand by for a moment, we are going to visit with Mr. Means by telephone.
Okay, Mr. Means, can you hear us?
I can.
All right, very good, sir. Then we will. The chair is returning to the mic, and we'll conduct the interview from here. Thank you very much.
Hi, Jim. This is Chuck Turbeville.
Hello, Chuck.
Yes, to the members of the executive board, as I explained before, Mr. Means was intending to come here 2 weeks ago. I rescheduled the meeting and he had a conflict, but I did want him to have the ability to visit with you. So, Jim, if you would, please go ahead.
Do you want me to just give a little background?
Yes, a little background and reasons why you would like to be on the committee, and then stand by for questions.
Okay. My background is I've got a bachelor's degree in business administration, And I first worked for Hart Schaffner Marks in a retail division, and then moved back to Yankton, bought into a family business, and eventually bought and managed that business until about 16, 17 years ago when I decided I wanted to do something different. And so at that time, I went to work for First Coast National Bank, and have worked there for the last a little over 15 years, and worked in the trust department, which effectively manages other people's assets in a fiduciary capacity. I think I told Chuck that I've been an investor for 35 or better years, and been a student of investing for the last 15 or 16. And during those 15 or 16 years, of what I've learned is how complicated the investment world is, and how important the very basics of the investment world are. And I mean, down to the very basics of buying low and selling high, and how basic some of those things are, but how very difficult they are to do. And is for the reason that I would like to be part of the South Dakota Investment Council, is I've followed it in generally for the last number of years. I have a great deal of respect for the organization. I think I have a pretty good background in investing, and could certainly understand the principles they're using, and would be interested in being involved. I apologize for the location, and I hope you can hear me okay. And I know there is some background noise, and I know that over the phone is a little more difficult, but I hope you can hear me, and I'll be able to hear your questions.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions from the executive board? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Jim, name's Larry Lucas, a representative from Mission. On your references, you had Steve Myers listed as one of your references, and, of course, we know who Steve Myers is, and being a past CEO of the Investment Council. What's your relationship with Steve? Have you had some acquaintance with him casually, or has it been business and professionally?
Well, for the last several years, I've served on the investment committee, the South Dakota Community Foundation, and Steve and I are both on that committee, and so I think Steve would have some knowledge of my abilities and my understanding of the investment world. So that's how I've known Steve for the last several years on the investment committee, the South Dakota Community Foundation with him.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Senator Larry Tiedemann from Brookings, South Dakota, Jim. And I saw that you have Larry Ness down as one of your references. What would Larry tell me about you that would be critical for putting you into this position?
Kind of scary what Larry might say in any situation, if you know Larry very well. I think Larry would tell you that I have a good working knowledge of the investment field, and that I'm not timid about saying what I think, and would certainly take part and be an involved member. Those are probably some of the things I would expect Larry to say. But I can't judge what he'd say.
Thank you, and I do know Larry Ness, and he's also a graduate of SDSU, and so I've met him a number of times. And you're right; you never know for certain, but I think you gave the right answers. Thank you.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Means, Representative Feinstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Means. In your position as a trust officer, you have a fiduciary responsibility. How could you relate that to the job as director on the Investment Council Board?
Well, I mean, what we do in the trust department is we manage other people's money and for their benefit, and our responsibility, which all fiduciaries' responsibility is, but it's held a pretty high standard in the trust department, is when you're managing people for other money for other people, your obligation is to do what is in their best interest, not anybody else's best interest. I mean, you're obligated to those people. And the South Dakota Investment Council, I mean, that's clearly what you're entrusted to do is to do whatever you think is in the best interest of those people's money that you're managing.
Follow up?
Well, and in that context, this is Mr. Representative Feinstein again. And how many years again have you been doing this, the trust office work, as a fiduciary?
Over 15 years.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none. Mr. Means, thank you so much for making yourself available, and I appreciate it.
Well, and I appreciate you making arrangements for me to be able to do this. I know it's a little bit cumbersome for you, but I appreciate the opportunity. Right. And thank you very much.
Thank you. The next candidate is Eric Lee from Rapid City. We'll see whether or not he's arrived yet. You can.
It's an oversight.
It just sneaks up on me.
It.
Your prowess as a leader just.
It does, you know. In spite of the.
Oh, that's right. The only one in the history of the state that's been given.
Wear it like a badge.
It's a badge of honor.
Wear it like a badge.
Not your dad.
It's a bell-shaped curve. One way or the other.
Funny thing is, he got credit for
two of my bills.
That's good reporting. That's great.
Mr.
Lee is not here, so we would. Oh, Eric Lee's too?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
So we'll actually, if it's okay with the board, we would do Mr. Raskin first.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Where do I start? Right here?
Yes, sir. Right up there. Make sure that the mic is on, members of the committee. This is Dan Rasby from Rapid City. Mr. Rasby, if you would, please.
My name is Dan Rasby, and I do have one qualification for the council that I'm absolutely sure fits the bill. I'm definitely not a Republican. But as Paul Harvey said, I'm here to tell you the rest of the story. I grew up in a Nebraska town of 860 people. I graduated from high school with 90% of my kindergarten class. I went on to the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and graduated in 1982 with a biology major with minors in chemistry and English. I have been married for 27 years, have 5 children, 3 biological, 2 adopted, 26, 24, 21, 10, and 9. Molly, my wife, and I moved to Rapid City in 1986. I started my working career as a pharmaceutical representative in 1984, which is the only other job I've had other than being a broker. In 1992, I became a stockbroker, hiring on as an independent with a firm called D.E. Fry. When D.E. Fry closed its doors in 1995, I went to work for Dean Witter, which became Morgan Stanley, which recently became Morgan Stanley Smith Barney. I work in the Rapid City office, and I have the title of Vice President. There are three qualities that I would bring to the South Dakota Investment Council. I speak the same language as the managers. I buy, sell individual stocks, bonds, options, and structured products in my clients' accounts. I know what asset allocation Morgan Stanley recommends for its institutional investors, what S&P and Value Line and many other institutions recommend, and I've most likely read in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times what institutions like Yale and Harvard or Eli Lilly are doing with their endowments. I'm aware of the different products the industry has to offer through, I'll just call Morgan Stanley MSSB, and the different salespeople that call in our office. I am not an expert in every asset class or market sector, but when in doubt, I collaborate with someone in the office or other professional associate to do what is best for the client. Representative Tuberville, which I think is Chairman Tuberville, correct? Today, asked in my screening interview, tell me about your day. I proceeded to tell him what time I got up, my children got up, etc., but finally did get around to his intent of what do I do at work. At the heart of his question was, give me some specifics of what you do and how it applies to oversight of assets. And I just want you to keep in mind that I know my job is not to manage assets, that my contribution to the council would be my knowledge, and I from my knowledge as a broker to be able to ask questions and to frame discussion, hopefully, for, you know, with the other council members. But anyway, I'll tell you about what I've done that has worked, but we'll work in a few misses. I had bought on the market decline in 2009 a leveraged ETF, exchange-traded fund, whose performance closely mimicked that of the S&P 500. If the S&P went up 1%, this investment went up approximately 2%, but also doubled the loss if the S&P went down. I bought a similar product on emerging markets that was leveraged 3 times versus the 2 times mentioned above. In the past 6 months, I have sold almost all the position on the S&P 500 and have taken out at least what the client invested in the emerging markets instrument. Financial institutions were beat to a pulp during the recent crisis, and bonds on institutions like Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, and others with 7 to 8% coupons were trading well below par, and I bought most at 75 to 85 cents on the dollar. When these bonds were trading at 105 to 110 recently, I sold. I've had success with products called reverse convertibles. I have bought REITs over the past months. I have bought leveraged ETFs that shorted gold 8 months ago. A disaster so far. I bought a double short on the long bond, thinking interest rates would go up. It hasn't worked yet. I have more cash than I usually do right now. The RevCons, or the reverse convertibles, represent large positions in my client accounts. The leveraged ETFs I have mentioned very little. I will wait till questions and answers to expand on what knowledge I use for the above if asked. Okay. Most holdings in a client's accounts have been there for years. My largest holdings are the likes of Franklin Income Fund and Berkshire Hathaway. I'm an early adapter, be it changes to the market, law, or technology. Curiosity and the love of learning are essentials in managing money. How I research stocks, how I communicate to the public and to my clients, and the amount of transparency I want to have with my clients have changed dramatically in the last 16 years. I've been a stockbroker. I have embraced all of this and look forward to the next 16 years. Last, I believe in public service. I have leveraged my association with MSSB, Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, to benefit my community. I have written grants for years to sponsor programming at Black Hills Community Theater and the Dolphins Arts Centers. I have encouraged others in our office to volunteer and write grants with the goal of MSSB giving more dollars back per employee than any other employer in Rapid City. I have served on various community and church boards. I help coach sports that my children in. I applied for the council because oversight of $9 billion is important, and I wanted you to have as many choices as possible to choose from to protect the citizens of South Dakota's assets. I hope my counterparts that interview will, or have, overwhelmed you with reasons for you to choose them. that you can say some talented South Dakotans have stepped up to the plate to serve the people of our state. Thank you for letting me present, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Dan. Do we have any questions? Yes, Senator Hunstead.
With respect to some of the last things you said, would you think that we should be using part of the capital that's invested as investments for South Dakota businesses, for example, to grow South Dakota businesses?
You know, a question like that, a specific question as far as first of all, it would take, I think it takes about a year to really get a feel for how a board works. And I don't know what the other investments that are held in the managers. And I also don't know, I see there's like seven or eight different funds, from a cash fund to a cement plant fund to a pension fund. And I assume all of those funds have investment policies as to what they can invest in and what they can't. And I suppose with something like that, a good place to start is to have it part of the investment policy and say, you know, 10% of the funds in this particular fund are going to go to South Dakota type investments. I suppose that's where I would start with something like that, that it would be part of an investment policy versus just out of the blue that I'd say it.
Senator, excuse me, Senator Tiedemann, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you were selected for this role on the Investment Council, what potential conflict do you see, and how would you handle the conflict between your current position as a stockbroker for a particular firm versus being on the Investment Council, where you can't, you know, take some of the information and use?
Of course. When I spoke with Matt, and I think also Mr. Fry, it seems the council itself already has policies in place to handle situations like that. And of course, you know, we are trained too, by law, or I think even at Morgan Stanley, that, you know, we can't use insider information of any way, shape, or form. So. And, you know, I do have to say right now that I have not, there are a lot of hoops that I have to jump through at Morgan Stanley if I'm chosen. And this is still going through our compliance department. You know, my understanding is, and I've disclosed to them that Morgan Stanley is the largest brokerage firm as far as your fixed income portfolio. It's not that they give advice, they just do the trades, and that relationship would end. So I'm not sure where that will end, but I think if I'm your man, then that relationship is over, and at least there's not that conflict. But it is a fine line. There is a fine line.
Thank you.
And hopefully I'll be able to, with some guidance from the other members and the management, get through it.
Other questions from the board? Seeing none?
I have questions.
Of course.
Are there investment policies for each one of these different funds? And, you know, how – well, that's my first question. Yes, okay.
Is someone else back there?
Okay, there is. All right. So that makes things easier. I thought, well, how far along are we?
We have
– Okay, so that was one of my questions. And Chris, Representative Konzett, did ask me at the screening interview about, you know, what I would get out of this. And any time – and I have gotten so much more out of every board and every association I've been associated with than I've probably ever given to those organizations. And so, you know, Chris, I just wanted to kind of complete my answer to you after I thought about it a little bit more, in that, you know, what I get out of it is immeasurable. The relationships that you you meet or you have with these other board members or the management team, not only professionally but personally, what I learn about a policy that I can take back to other nonprofits, back to my business. But, I mean, there is a lot of benefit for me, too. I didn't want you to think that, oh, he doesn't think there's anything.
Do you have any other questions of us?
Well, you should have told me, as Eric, we could have rode together.
All right, well.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One other question.
Representative Lucas.
Last fall, we did have this football game with SDSU and the University of Nebraska.
Omaha.
Who did you root for?
That was the University of Nebraska, Omaha. You wouldn't have had a chance against the Cornhuskers.
That's who we played.
Mr. Chair.
No, you played you did play the Cornhuskers. Yeah, of course I voted for the Cornhuskers all the way. That's right.
Mr. Chair.
And that's right. It ended up, it was the first game, and it was close.
Do we have any other pertinent questions?
Just as a point of clarification, if the two touchdowns had not been called back that the officials totally blew, the score would have been tied. But the fans in Nebraska were fantastic, and they said SDSU did a super job against a national competitive team.
Which you did.
All right. With that, Mr. Ashby, thank you very much for coming today.
Uh-huh.
Excellent job.
Bye-bye.
Eric, please have a seat.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
All right. Board, we have our final applicant. His name is Eric Lee from Rapid City. Welcome, Mr. Lee.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
If you would, take a few minutes, tell us about yourself, especially about your investment background.
Okay.
And then we'll see if there's some questions.
Yeah, my investment background started 30 years ago. Seriously, I was 13, mowing lawns, and my dad made me put 50 cents of every dollar I made mowing lawns in the eighth grade into a mutual fund, and that was the beginning. That's the truth. I still own the fund today. But seriously, I graduated from the University of Wyoming in 1990, and immediately pursued a career in the investment services business. And have been doing so since then. I want to add one comment to my eighth grade story. That was the foundation of my long-term philosophy. And I also learned as a sophomore at 15 years of age that avoiding serious loss is the most important rule. Because at that time, I was allowed to invest in options, and specifically in Wendy's Corporation at that time, and that taught me the important lesson of don't lose your capital. But all seriousness aside, I have been raised in the investment business. My father's been in the investment business for 45 years in the Black Hills, so I would say it's kind of in my blood. And upon graduating from college, began my career as an investment consultant with Dean Witter in Denver, Colorado. My training has not been as a portfolio manager. That's an important distinction because it's a confusion among most of the public. I've been trained as an investment consultant and trained in the investment fiduciary process, and I come to you today with that background and with that distinction that I don't see myself as replacing or trying to second guess or be in the business of picking stocks and bonds. That's the investment office does a great job of that, but I'm certainly aware of everything that goes on in that office and how the process should work most effectively. So I've spent a couple years at various large investment firms, and 10 years ago chose to become independent, was not pleased in the corporate world. I was literally trained in the investment business by one of the largest firms in the country, that 2 out of 3 isn't bad. And it's sad, but 2 out of 3 meaning it's good for the broker, good for the firm, 2 out of 3 isn't bad. And in 2001, had enough of that and started my own independent firm where we could provide fiduciary services to clients without the brokerage world background. I've been there ever since. So,
are there any questions from the board? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of have two questions, if that's all right.
Of course.
Eric, for the other applicants, there was a form, an application form, and I don't know if that's something that you chose not to follow. You wrote the letters. Did you get that form?
I did not get that form. I just literally saw the notice in the Rapid City Journal and submitted to the
okay.
LRC.
All right. Well, one of the questions would be references, because we asked for 3 references. So are you prepared to list names of references?
I could certainly do so. If you give me a moment to put that together, I can certainly do that by the end of the day. Absolutely.
All right. And then the other question, if I could continue, Mr. Chair, is then one of them asked for the political party that you're affiliated with.
I'm an independent.
Have you ever been affiliated with a Democratic or a Republican party?
I was a Republican until January of 2009.
Okay.
Further questions? So just to be fair, give me 3 people off the cuff that you would have as a reference.
Okay.
Who that might be?
I would contact Dr. Randy Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S, and I can give you his contact information.
That's okay.
Yeah. I would reference Dr. and Mrs. Judy Allen. Robert and Judy Allen in Rapid City, and I would be happy to reference Dr. Thomas Krafka in Rapid City as well.
Now, those are people you know personally. You've done business.
Done business.
With? Business.
Business.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good. Thank you.
For the Democrats, Judy Duhamel in Rapid City would be a good character reference. For my integrity.
We do have Democrats here, don't we? All right. Yes, Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the letter, you said that you maintain a Series 7 securities license. Could mm-hmm. you explain that to me?
Series 7 securities license is a license that you'll see among a couple of the candidates today. That's a license that allows you to legally sell and offer securities, anything registered by the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Further questions? Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elaborate, you mentioned earlier that you were different, or you had a slightly different role perhaps than your standard stockbroker or whatever. Elaborate on that and tell me what you mean by the different role that you see yourself in.
There's a distinction in our industry between investment salespeople and investment advisors. So I'm a registered investment advisor. I'm held to a fiduciary standard every day. I advise of about 150 families. It represents about $155 million that have entrusted their assets to me and my firm under a fiduciary basis. A stockbroker is trained in investment sales and has no fiduciary responsibility. Doesn't mean they're bad people. Everything in the world needs to be sold. But we approach the business really from two different angles. And I approach it and am forced to approach it, have chosen to approach it from a fiduciary standpoint where I am obligated to act in the client's best interest. A Series 7 securities license gives you the legal right to sell securities, and the law defines that as a sales transaction, and you're not obligated to work in the client's best interest. Even though it would be natural and you would assume so, you're not obligated, as we've seen in the financial crisis the last few years. Plenty of firms and plenty of people acted in their own self-dealing. That's a role I've chosen because it's what I believe in, and I love the responsibility. And if you have nothing to hide and you're doing things right, shouldn't be a problem for people.
Further questions? Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's right. We're going to have to separate. It's too close.
Yeah.
But that's just an inside joke for us. As you look at the investment council, it's truly a team made up of folks that come from across the state, different political parties, but they function as a team, each contributing different factors to that total effort as a group. Recognizing that as you come in, it's a learning curve for you, but what would be the greatest strength that you would bring to the team as you, if you were appointed on this council?
Right, not knowing the other members, it's a little bit difficult to answer that. But I do, go ahead, sorry.
Well, just to clarify, your strength, not thinking about what the other people are bringing, but
right.
What you would bring.
Yeah. My strength is in understanding all of the investment process that's going on in Sioux Falls, understanding all of the investment vehicles, understanding how to do due diligence, what questions to ask, the jargon and so forth. Quite frankly, my weakness might be that I'm more right-brained, and other people on the investment board are probably more left-brained and more analytical. You see that maybe in a chartered financial analyst. I think that's perfect. I think that's a blend. Investing is not science and it's not art. It does take different minds and different perspectives, and so I do understand the art of it. I understand the science as well, but I think I have a strong background in really what's happening. I think that's more important now than ever. Not that it's ever been easy, but I understand what it's like for to have a money manager pitching you, and they want you to place money with them. And I understand the games they play. I understand the lingo. I understand what questions to ask. I understand how to differentiate between the what I call the doers and the bluffers. Not that the investment office can't do that, but we do have an oversight responsibility in that process.
Further questions? Do you have any questions of us?
I do not at this time.
All right. Well, thank you for making the long trip here. Excellent job. And okay. we appreciate it. Thank you.
But I guess if I made the last question, would be what's the process from this point?
We will go into an executive session, discuss the interviews, and come out and make a decision.
Today?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Within the next few minutes.
Okay. So we should stay in attendance?
We're going into it. Yes, you can just wait out in the hall, but we will be going into an executive session.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. And with that, I would ask for a motion to go into executive session.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The board is back in regular session at this time. I would entertain a motion in regard to the selection of the candidate for the investment council. Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we appoint Jim Means from Yankton to the investment council.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Tiedemann. Any further questions or comments?
I would just say I think the process this year was good and maybe even better in the past, where we took the time to go out and visit with all the candidates that applied on a one-on-one basis through subcommittees. Granted, a process was delayed because of the unusual weather this summer in South Dakota, and we had to delay the final decision till today from 2 weeks ago. But nonetheless, I think all of the process worked well. We had some excellent candidates, and we would encourage those that were not selected to apply next year. Each year there is one position that's open on the investment council.
Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add that I really think this is one of the most important appointments that this board makes. It's important for the people of South Dakota. I think we had excellent candidates. I was very pleased to see that particularly the finalists had very strong investment credentials. I think that's very important, at least for this particular appointment. I appreciate all their efforts in coming here to interview today. I look forward perhaps to seeing one or more of them back for an appointment in another year. I think we'll have a good candidate on board, and I do appreciate the effort that we went through to sort through all of these good candidates. Thank you.
Further questions, comments? Seeing none, the motion before the board at this time is to select Jim Means as the newest member of the Investment Council. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Secretary, please call the roll. The secretary is preparing to call the roll.
Yes, which I shall now do. Senators Gray, Hustad. Senator Hustad, Maher,
no.
Nelson,
aye.
Tiedemann,
aye.
Teason,
aye.
Representatives Abdallah,
aye.
Carson,
aye.
Consett,
aye.
Feinstein,
aye.
Lucas,
aye.
Roush?
Aye.
Venner?
No.
Cutler? And Chair Turbeville?
Aye.
So it's
Motion carried.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. At this time, we'll take a 10-minute recess.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right, let's go back to our original agenda, and the next item on the list would be the LRC Director's Report. Director Fry, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go very quickly. The financial statement, you will see that you have done a very good job of husbanding your resources. We will have something in the neighborhood of $200,000 to revert unless there's something that shows up. Last Friday was actually the day, last day that we can that we could put items into BFM to have them paid out of this year's funds. So we have run past that, so you would have to beg permission. The reason that we're ahead of the game at this point is that there were significant savings in two areas: interim committees from last year, because we had so very few, and the computers, wherein we bought them last year for a very good price, and frankly have made good use of the used machines, and as a result have saved a significant amount of money. So we will we have been good stewards. You have been good stewards, and we'll be returning some money to the general fund. So. Second item on the deal is the I've included a copy of the LRC budget as we have loaded. It's called loading it onto the rolling budget, and it's your chance to put the money out on the computer system in a way that reflects your expenditures. And several members had asked that we that we report back as to how we have loaded the extra $100,000 that was granted to the legislature for interim meetings, and you will find that on page 3 of the legislative budget under the heading of interim committees. You will see on the final line, interim committee total, there's $81,532. That is the $100,000. It reflects the fact that we were going to lose another $15,000, so you had to offset with that. So we really only walked out of there with a little over $80,000 to spend, but we do have money in the budget, and so we and it is entirely within the subject area of interim committees. So, and that's what it was intended for, and that's what it'll spend for. Beyond that, unless there are questions about that and how we do that sort of thing, otherwise the budget is as it was passed and approved by the Appropriations Committee after their review during the session. Next item, we have copies in here. Members asked for a copy of the travel, out-of-state travel report. We have that in, it's in two pages, and you will see that we spent very, very little money in that regard this year. Very, very little out-of-state travel was expended by the Legislative Research Council, I believe.
Chair? Yes. Representative Roush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're on out-of-state travel, it was brought to my attention that we just recently had another member elected as a vice chair at NCSL, one of the committees, and they were asking for clarification. I believe we approved chair and vice chairs.
That is correct.
Okay, so then I believe that Senator Peters was appointed as a vice chair. So
right. Yes, the travel policy that we agreed to early on was that for out-of-state travel, if you were a chair or a vice chair of a national committee, then your travel expenses would be paid. Okay.
Just for clarification.
Thanks. Yes, thank you.
And for our, so when we get requests or reimbursements, we know that it's approved.
All right. Anything else?
Since I got 2 seconds here, I just a quick report on our International Legislative Forum.
Please.
That we had in Brookings. That has been held and been completed, and the subject matters evolved mostly around energy, wind energy, and we avoided oil because North Dakota was the only one that wanted to talk about oil. But we had some good tours. We had some good participation, with the exception of Manitoba, who for obvious reasons is knee-deep in water. Everywhere they look up there, they are the source and also the draining point for what's going through Minot right now. And so that they were struggling with flooding to magnitudes that we're seeing locally here, just pretty amazing stuff. But in the end, the sponsorships were did cover all of the our hosting. And in the end, I think from our state, we're only going to have reimbursements from five of us, maybe? Me, myself, because Representative Hawley sat in for Senator Hansen, who is recovering from a fall he took. So he couldn't make it, and of course, our substitute then lived locally, so it has no expenses. So in the end, I'm assuming I have a folder at home in my mail that I got this week to send back reimbursements, but I've been gone all week, so I. But that was a good success. I think the wind energy the energy companies that were present to listen or to give test or to give reports on the different states, I think were very pleased with the subject matter and what was discussed, and also the turnout. So I would call it a success, and I was very proud of South Dakota, and everybody was very pleased with our hosting. So that's, unless Senator Tiedemann has anything to offer above that.
All right. Well, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Lucas.
Thank you. Just to, for clarification on the travel policy, and I have that here, it's for NCSL, CSG, or Midwest Legislative Conference. And then it says no legislator chair, and I think they mean vice chair, may be authorized to attend more than one out-of-state national organizational meeting. So the way I interpret that, we'll pay for one of their travel meetings. Is that correct?
If that's what the policy says, that is correct, yes.
And this will start now with July 1st.
Yes. Any other comments? Senator?
Well, this is a complicated process because we end up with year end.
if I might. I ran this report so that I could mail it out to you. So it was run ahead of the time that you put it in and so on. We tried hard, and if we had it sometime early enough in the week, we should be okay. We should be able to get it into this year's, because we would have been able to do it by Friday. It's purely a matter of timing, and if you get it down there in time, it'll come out of this year's, and we'll be fine. So we'll be fine next year too. These are not huge items, but.
Thank you.
Any other questions on Senator Maher?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. On the travel, who is Jesse A. Hyatt?
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Please.
Jesse Hyatt is our computer programmer. He took Scott Darnell's place. He was here during session, too. So, but Jesse's new, and we sent him to what I would call a bit twiddlers conference. That is an actual programmers conference where he worked with the kinds of software development tools, Visual Studio primarily, that he uses to develop and to maintain the state's or the legislative website. So that was to get him up to speed.
Any further questions or comments? All right. Director Frey, if you would proceed, please.
As you know, there were several people that traveled hither and thither to pre-clear or to pre-interview the investment council applicants this year, and there is a request or a couple of requests for consideration for at least mileage, not necessarily per diem or pay or anything like that, but at least highway mileage given the cost of gas for those individuals. And so that is why that is an item on your agenda. Please do what you wish.
Representative Roush, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it'd be appropriate, I would make a motion that we approve reimbursement of mileage.
Is there a second? We have a motion and a second. Questions, comments? Representative Roush?
No, I just appreciate the effort you guys put in to get around to see the candidates to make our job here today easier. So thank you very much.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign, motion carried. Thank you. Next item.
Okay, the next item, we had taken some action previously on the healthcare working group, and the direction was that we would pay if this is an executive branch task force, and they have really split up into a number of different study groups, working groups, whatever you want to call them. The overall group is the task force. They're studying Medicaid solutions, among other things, and there was a question about who is paying what. As it stands right now, the governor's office is paying their actual mileage, hotel, that and meals, that sort of thing. So the question is whether we were going to pay per diem or not. We have paid because of the direction earlier. We have been paying them per diem where it wasn't held in conjunction with another meeting. So they have been getting 110 from us at this point. The issue to be determined here is: do you want that to continue into FY12? And that's just it. It requires a yay or nay. Tell us what to do. We'll do it.
Senator Hunstad.
Well, I happen to have been participating in that, and I haven't sent anything out with respect to being reimbursed. I've kind of always been wondering how this is working, but I've been just doing it. If we decide, you say in the past they have, because I haven't turned in anything.
For the meetings we've held in the FY11 fiscal year, we have paid the 110.
Representative Roush.
Now, you said currently that the governor's budget is paying for mileage and the meals for their travel. Is that lodging? Is that correct? Is that what I heard?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We were advised by Deb Bowman in the governor's office that they are paying the mileage and paying for hotel rooms when applicable and for meals when applicable. At standard state government employee rates.
So I guess the question, Senator Tiedemann.
Mr. Chair, now this will have precedence on a number of other task force that he has appointed. because I had at the appropriations meeting last week, I think they identified like seven different task force that the governor has appointed. So it's not just the two people or four people that are serving on the Medicaid. This will have implications on all of those task forces that he's put out there.
That is correct. So I guess the question right now is, do we want to pay for these task force? And I think it's already been established, but we'll pay for mileage, meals, and hotel. So leave it at that, or add the minimum of 110 per day. Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm kind of an advocate of you get what you pay for. So if we want our legislators to attend these meetings, and I'm assuming they're a full-day meeting, then we ought to pay them a per diem. And, you know, expenses, if they can come from someplace else, so be it. But if the governor is appointing these people, there should be some maybe responsibility from his office, too, to also, you know, pay the expenses like that. I think that's a fair trade-off if the governor pays the expenses and we go ahead and do the per diems.
Representative Abdallah.
Well, that was kind of my question, Mr. Chairman. If the governor's office is paying meals, motel, and mileage, then we're going to pay per diem besides?
That is the question.
Pardon me?
That is the question, yes.
Why would we pay double?
Oh, no, no. No, we're not paying double. The governor's office is paying for those non-members.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That takes care of that.
I can do it. Sure.
Yeah. If I might, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
Historically, in the summer, in the interim, the legislature has paid... You get per diem during the session, but in the summer, in the interim, the legislature has paid for its own interim committees the standard state per diem, boardroom mileage, that sort of thing, to legislators, and in addition to that, has paid the $110 a day, which is per diem during the session, but during the interim, that is paid as a salary. And that is the question here. So in this particular case with the Medicaid Solutions Group, the governor's office is paying that the room and board and mileage, and the decision here is whether or not the legislature would then pay the $110 as salary.
Director Fry, now when it comes to other legislative trips, in a few moments we're going to be talking about an East River Ag Committee tour. Is it my understanding that those individuals who are on the tour only receive mileage, room if necessary, and food and meals, but would not receive the per diem of 110?
Yeah, that's correct. We've only done this once before, the egg trip, but that was what happened then. They got whatever travel expenses, you know, that they would normally incur if they were a state employee, but they did not receive the $110 per diem.
Senator Teason.
Question, why? They decided amongst themselves on that, or?
No, the egg board did not authorize it. The historically, we have said, the executive board has said that we will only pay salary and per diem for those groups which are appointed either by the legislature during the session by law or resolution, or were appointed, created and appointed by the executive board as an interim committee. That's the history of all this. And we have deviated from that from time to time, specifically for various groups.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm going to concur, I think, with Representative Lucas. I just think that we should avoid nickel and diming ourselves to death. It's hard enough to get citizens of this state to
run and participate in the legislature as it is. And I'm sure there are people out there that would like to serve in the legislature but just can't quite figure out how to make it work financially. For some of us, it's easy. We're retired and independently wealthy. In some cases, both, although I'm not sure that applies to me, but I'm partway there. So if we take it to the next step, then we're talking about legislators who have chosen to serve and now are up for committee appointments and assignments and doing additional work, which some people can do and some people can't do. But I would hate to further divide this legislature into those that can and those that can't afford to. And it just seems to me if we ask people to do the work, that we shouldn't have to have people thinking about or actually saying, no, I can't do that. I can't take the day off. Like I said, it applies to some and probably doesn't apply to many, but I would just hate to start the process of weeding people out by those that can pay the extra cost on their own and those that are can't. I mean, we're already doing it on, say, for example, out-of-state travel, people that want to represent the state and go for further training and go to one of the conferences and do it. Well, right now the only ones that can go are the ones that have enough financial means to do it on their own. That's the way it is. It's unfortunate that we're in that sort of situation, but I really don't want to compound that by starting to nickel and dime us with these appointments. If the governor asked him to serve, I think the legislator ought to be willing to compensate him the $100. Thank you.
Representative Rausch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we approve salary pay and normal travel expenses if not provided by the hosting committee. So if you're appointed by this body or appointed by the governor, if they cover it, great. We pay what portion of that is not covered?
For in-state.
Well, for in-state travel, yes.
Second.
We already have an out-of-state travel policy, so it would be.
Second by Senator Thiessen. All right. Any further comments, questions?
Just, Mr. Chair, a quick question on that.
Senator Feinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the motion then read, is the mileage going to always be the same and the hotel expense per diem always going to be the same? Or if there's a difference, do we pick up the difference, or is it always going to be the same?
Director Fry.
Technically, the mileage will always be the same. We use the finance board's rates for both mileage and hotel room, and unless you can find a hotel room for less than, $47, which is, unless you're planning on pitching a tent, that's pretty hard to do. So yeah, it's pretty much always the same.
Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, so everybody understands, this is just for legislators that are appointed to these work groups and task force by the governor, not for the other members.
That is correct.
From the public.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question then, to be consistent, the International Legislative Forum was appointed by the legislature, the members to go to that. Do we get to enjoy that $110 per day with this motion? And I ask that as a question. And then my second question is, how many of these folks said yes, knowing that there was no $110 coming?
Who might wish to answer
that? That was rhetorical.
Oh. So, but the question stands.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes, Representative.
We were here in our previous meeting 2 months ago and approved what we did for the International Legislative Forum. I don't think that is retroactive. We are now into the new fiscal year, and we can already smooth that over and say that's in the previous fiscal year. But we got what we asked for with the International Legislative Forum. I came and asked for reimbursement of room mileage and begged and pleaded that it would be less expensive because we had some at-home lodging and those types of things, and that was approved. I'm not going back and asking for the salary for that. I think we got what we asked for. We knew it up front. We went and attended, and we did that. I think it's from today, this vote forward, if it passes, that the policy would be in effect for the 2012 fiscal year.
Any further comments? Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, while I agree with a lot of the discussion that we serve for little or nothing, I also think it sends a different message when we reward ourselves when our expenses are going to be covered. So I can't support the motion because I know most of these people said yes, knowing that the $110 was not coming.
Further comments? Questions? Seeing none, we have a motion before the board, and the motion is that we will pay per diem in addition to mileage, lodging, and meals.
Well, whichever portion is not covered by...
is not covered by another group, organization, or department. All right. With that in mind, we'll call the roll. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, nay. Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Gray, Hunstad.
Aye.
Maher.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Tiedemann.
No.
Thiessen.
Aye.
Representatives Abdallah. Carson?
No.
Consett?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Lucas?
Aye.
Roush?
Aye.
Benner?
Aye.
Cutler? Chair Chervokin?
No.
Motion carried.
Motion carried. Okay. That will be our, I wouldn't call it our new travel policy, but it would be.
It is what it is.
Okay.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, for the direction, this is good for the FY 2012 fiscal year or budget year. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Continuing.
Now, I just included a copy of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in a conflict of interest case arising out of Nevada. That's just for your interest. That has no effect on South Dakota. It has to do with an analysis and interpretation of a Nevada state law on conflicts of interest. But because this question comes up so much, I thought at least, and this is the first time that I know of, that the Supreme Court has opined on the issue in the modern era, that it was worth at least sending the decision out to you. But it's not anything that I intended to send any message or anything like that, other than that there is, you know, that this decision was reached, and it's for your review, and that's all it's for. So,
everybody understand, Senator Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, sort of a one sentence summary of this would be that a state can, if it desires, opt to pass a conflict of interest statute, and Supreme Court says that would then be enforceable.
That is correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
Limited by the structure of the Nevada law, but that was pretty broad. So, you know, so I think most things would pass muster, it looks like.
But, do you have any comment, Mr. Chair? But as they say, Feinstein, nothing is unconstitutional or constitutional until the court opines on it. So, and some things like this are so specific to whatever it was, like.
All right. Director Fry, do you have anything else for your report?
No, sir, I do not. I have completed my report.
Are there any questions or comments regarding the report? If not, we'll move on the budget. The next item is the appointment of Uniform Laws Commissioner. Nancy Trebek has resigned. Consequently, we have two because Representative Tom Diedrich's term has expired or will July 1st. Is that correct?
July 31st.
July 31st. And so we have seven individuals that have applied. And unlike the investment council, we have not invited individuals to come and speak to the executive board. I know some have called, sent letters, what have you. So with that in mind, and to get on with the business, we will have a secret ballot. You are to vote for two, and we will have the director and my appointed vice chair, Senator Nelson, count the ballots. It is we will two names on one sheet, and in order to be selected, you must have a majority of the members present. We have 13. So you're going to need 7 votes. And if no one is selected on the first ballot, then we will take the individual who has received the fewest number of votes. They'll be dropped and we'll vote again. I'm sure that will reflect in your vote. We will stand at ease while we're waiting here.
You think every lawyer is on this list?
What
was your question again?
Senate Bill 38.
Name a lawyer, and they're all lawyers.
That's
not on this list.
I mean, the staff that by South Dakota Constitution that we have to have 2/3 majority vote on those bills.
He's already on.
The question is, do we need more legislators on this group?
Do we need more lawyers?
Yeah. Well, except that they are trying to make sure that we're
doing the laws. Law degree.
I'm glad I'm not on that list.
Now, to spend the money on it will be a 2/3 vote in appropriations.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have made a decision on the first ballot, and they received a majority of the votes of the members present. The two new members of the Uniform Laws Commission are Representative Gosch and Representative Feinstein. Representative Abdullah, yes. Must you?
No, not me.
He sits over and tells me stuff, and then he won't tell you.
You know, I'm okay with that. I'm certainly okay with that if you two. May we proceed? Or do you really have something to tell us?
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. All right. Next item on our agenda is the consideration of East River Ag Committee tour. Mr. Fry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of years ago, the Department of Agriculture and the, I believe, Department of Environment and Natural Resources sponsored a tour of various facilities through in the state that have an ag basis, and they did so to help familiarize the ag committees with certain basically economic development initiatives that are going along, along with some research opportunities as well. And so you, they are sponsoring such a tour this year for members of both House Standing House Ag and Standing Senate Ag. And they have asked, is some of that will be covered by sponsorship fees. There's a bus that takes the members around, so that, I think, is paid for. And we are have been asked to stand at least maybe one night's lodging at standard state rates and one or more meals. We do not know how many at this point. Last year, if the per diem or that $110 a day is not included, the last time we did this, it cost about $9,000. So this year they will look at the Deer Creek Power Station, SDSU Agricultural Research. They will go to the GFP Outdoor Campus in Sioux Falls, the Bones Farm, TransCanada Pump Station, Lewis and Clark Regional Water Treatment Plant, that's assuming it's above water, Blood Run State Park, assuming the same, a company called Dakota Provisions, and then Lake Thompson Recreation Area. So those are the main things that they will do it. They'll begin from the state fairgrounds and basically proceed on a two-day tour. So there will be one night out on the tour, and that's open to all members of the Ag Committee, the Standing Ag Committees.
How many members would that be?
I believe there are 13 House members. I didn't bring my red book along, but it's 9 and 13 or 9 and 15. So it's a substantial number of folks.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Maher.
I think I'm just guessing one of the few members on the Ag Committee, but we did this last year, 2 years ago out west, and I didn't think it cost us the legislature anything. I thought everything was covered because the lodging was taken care of by Custer State Park, and the meals were all provided for, and it was raised by different ag organizations.
Right. It depends on how much. That's what it would cost. That's what we figured out what it would cost. It would be $9,000 would be the cost to us. And then it depends on how much private sponsorship they get. So I should have made that clear, and I apologize for that. But that's the outside. If there's not $110 paid, the outside cost would be somewhere around $9,000. But yes, it depends on how much is paid by the outside groups and so on.
So based on one of our most recent decisions, is it my understanding that the members that take the ag tour would receive the per diem of $110 per day? That's not.
My understanding is they would receive meals, lodging, mileage, which is whatever those is not covered.
Of whatever is not covered. All right.
It's not a committee. It's just a tour. It's not a.
It's not a committee. It's not a committee that has been appointed by someone. Thank you. All right. Representative Abdullah.
Just a question. The Ag Committee tour, is there a Judiciary Committee tour and a Commerce Committee tour and all these other tours?
Not yet.
No, not to my knowledge, sir.
Judiciary
Committee is
going to spend 3 nights at the panel.
Thank you.
I'm serious. I'm serious about this. I mean, why are we singling out one committee and having this tour when and Senator Teason was speaking in jest, but I mean, if we're going to have a judiciary tour, we'll go to the panel, we'll go to the police department, we'll go to the sheriff's office, we'll go here and there, and the Commerce Committee can go to the Chamber of Commerce. And where do you draw the line?
Representative Rausch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just since I've been here in the 7 years, the historically, the GOAC has taken a committee, appropriations usually together. They do that, one East River, one West River, depending on the year they've rotated that. Ag has always had a committee tour. And, you know, part of its tradition, is it necessary? Maybe that's a whole different discussion. I think appropriations and the money side is a little bit more appropriate, because you get a chance to look at the things that you're funding or being asked to fund, or to find out how that money was spent rather than just seeing it on a piece of paper all the time. But I'm not opposed to these tours. I would like to see them sponsored from the outside a little more. I think that would be just fine. And I think that's the reason we're not going to do salary and just allow some expenses to be reimbursed. But
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe the Appropriations is a constitutional committee, and GOAC, or Government Operations and Audit Committee, is a statutory committee, versus the other committees are standing committees. So I think there is some subtle differences there. Appropriations has chosen not to do a tour this year. They chose not to do one last year because of the financial conditions that we were faced with in the state, and as a savings of money. My understanding of this one that came forth from the two agricultural committees is that they were going to cover the expenses, and they did not expect the per diem or salary during those days that they were there. Now, there may be, you know, some small slippage, and as I heard Director Fry, he says the upper amount is $9,000, but the rest of it, they're looking at sponsorships and others to cover the expenses. They're not asking us to cover it.
Well, I think it's already been established that there will not be per diem paid on this tour, correct?
Salary.
Yeah, so all we're looking at is it would be lodging, mileage, and meals that are not provided by some other entity. Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is maybe a little side note to this, but a question. Like, I mean, I see in my area stops, you know, the Game Fishing Park Outdoor Campus, Blood Run, and maybe even the Trans-Canada Pump Station. Are other legislators that are in the area going to be able to go and at least attend that? Would that be appropriate? Would that be inappropriate? I would think it would be real beneficial, not looking to be reimbursed, but just to voluntarily say, hey, I want to join them at Blood Run. I want to join them at the Outdoor Campus.
I don't see why that would not be appropriate. If you wish to go ahead, and if you're not a member of the Agriculture Committee, one of them, and you want to stop in and take the tour, I would guess that would certainly be okay. On your own dime. Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say that from past experiences, if you travel West River, you'll find that you'll be taken care of better and have more sponsorship. That's why the costs were less. So maybe the East River legislators ought to pick up a little bit on this. Would you agree with that, Mr. Chair?
I absolutely would. I think that's an excellent idea. So, Director Fry, you're looking consideration of East River Ag Committee tour. So, yes.
Are you looking for motion?
I am.
And approval of the tour?
Yes.
Or reimbursement thereof if not provided by private sources?
Yes.
I would make that motion.
Is there a second? Seconded by Senator Tiedemann.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abdallah.
Thank you. I have a substitute motion.
State your motion.
That this tour be approved by this committee only if all expenses are paid by private donation.
We have a motion. Is there a second to that motion? Motion dies for lack of a second. We're now back to the original motion, which is to go ahead and approve the East River Ag Committee tour, paying those expenses that are not covered by some other entity. Questions, comments before we vote? All right, well, this will be a roll call vote. All in favor say aye. Opposed, no. Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Gray, Hunstad.
No.
Mohar.
Aye.
Nelson.
Aye.
Tiedemann.
Aye.
Thiessen.
Aye.
Representatives Abdallah.
No.
Carson.
No.
Consett.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Roush.
Aye.
Benner.
Aye.
Cutler. Chair Turbidor.
No. Motion carries. All right. Next item, report of the Computer Technology Subcommittee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucas.
Thank you. I attended just a little bit of the meeting this morning, but Lou was there and presented the Autobound software that the redistricting committee is using. And that software is available for legislators to use and for the public with some limitations. First of all, it's a very somewhat expensive program, and it does not work very well, if at all, outside of the Capitol. So in order to come in and draw some maps, you need to come to the Capitol and work with LRC staff. Obviously, if there's some common interest groups and or legislators from a particular area that can get together at a particular time, plan to spend the day, and come and travel to Pierre and work with the software. It is very thorough. It works down identifying where residents are on a block-by-block basis, so you can draw maps very accurately, and as you affect one area of the state, it compensates for the other areas of the state. There will be 35 legislative districts. That's a decision the redistricting committee has made, and Representative Roush is a chair of that. He may want to add some more comments. He's seen the software demonstrated at least twice now and has a little more information on that. But it is available with limitations, and I would encourage people that want to try to draw maps to contact LRC and make your appointment. Thank you.
Representative Roush.
I guess just to piggyback on that, for those that are listening in and have not had a chance to look at redistricting minutes or follow along, I'll just give a summary of where that's at. Senator Cutler's not here today because they are working on what they call conurbation district for Sioux Falls today. And maybe I'm not sure if they're going to finish up their work today in one meeting, but they have not been able to take the design program with them, but they've had several maps and pretty fine detailed right down to the precincts to work from, printed off so that they could do that. So that type of activity is available. It is a lengthy process, again, as Representative Lucas has indicated. If you're going to draw some maps and make some significant changes, it could take the better part of a full day. So make sure you call in and make sure that the equipment is available for your needs. Once the conurbation districts are established, we'll meet in towards the end of July. I believe it's the last Monday in July. I'm looking at Mr. Fry, but I think that's the date that we picked, the last Monday of July. And they will present their proposal to us, both from the Rapid City Conurbation Subcommittee and the Sioux Falls. And once those are adopted, then the next step for us will be to get input from the Indian reservations and the Native American groups to see if there's a preference or something that we can do to address their needs and concerns. And then we will have one final meeting to then piece together the rest of the state and look at those options. And we will adopt one and make a recommendation then at our special session in October for approval by the full legislative body.
Further questions, comments? Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We have we're down at the end, and we have two items from members of the e-board that were not on the original agenda. So, Senator Tiedemann, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was designated by the Appropriations Committee in a motion to bring this issue to the Executive Board. We came out of the legislative session in 2008. We had passed a bill at that time, and it was signed by the governor, that we as a state would join the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. That gave us two regular members and two alternates. Our dues to that membership are paid right around the July date, July 1st, either ahead of or beyond. When the bill was passed, the $95,000 was put into the governor's budget. That was cut out of the governor's budget a year ago. It came to the executive board, and we found some money that was going to be reverted from the legislature, LRC, and legislative audit, and used a portion of that to pay our dues. When the bill was passed, it states specifically in the enactment that we have to give them 2 years' notice that we're going to drop out of the membership before we can be freed up from our dues. So the state, we owe the Midwestern Higher Education Compact $95,000 this coming year. We have two options, as I see it, as we discussed in Appropriations Committee last week. One, there's dollars that we've already learned from Director Fry that are going to be reverted to the state, that we could use a portion of that to pay our dues for this coming year. I have cleared it with the Commissioner Dilges and the auditor that even though the deadline was noon today to get everything in because they're a past customer, they will allow it to go. I mean, they don't have to create a new format, new program. That's one option. We use what's going to be reverted and pay the bill now. Second option is that each year through the appropriations process, a bill comes forward where we amend the current year's fiscal bill. And we could add it on at that time. Problem number one, we don't know if we'll have an extra $95,000 next year. Problem number two is that we're going to be about 9 months in the rear of our payment. We currently have a member of our body and that is serving as vice chair and will be serving as chair this coming year. It's tough to sit as chair and ask other states to contribute when you haven't made your contribution. So I think we're putting two of our members in a very bad situation. Senator Haverly is the current a member from the Senate, and Representative Wismer is the member from the House. And then Representative Perry is also the alternate from the House, and I can't remember who the senator from the minority party is because it's alternates back and forth. But I know they were appointed. No, but they were appointed by the executive board. So it is kind of our responsibility, one, to pay our bills, and two, to move forward. But I see it as two options, and I will stand by for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Would you please explain to the board what this organization does, how we use it?
The Midwestern Higher Education Compact is composed really of the 12 North Central states, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Wisconsin. They form together, and it's the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. It's more than just the Regental system. It also includes the Native American colleges. That there's benefits, and I'll explain those benefits in a minute, Mr. Chair, as well as the tech schools. The board that is elected, one is appointed by the governor, two are appointed as full members, two are appointed by the executive board representing the legislature, one comes from the tech school, and one comes from the Department of Education. So it's not just higher ed that is involved in this process. Some of the benefits are pooling to purchase equipment that can be purchased by school districts, that can be purchased by other state government entities. One thing is a savings on the insurance that we pay on all of our facilities for the state. Although the contract was not awarded to the MEC group, they did have a savings of about $90,000 in that 1 year, just because of the competition in the bidding process. This past year, there has been a savings to the state, total state, of about $68,000. That was on purchase of computers. Also looking, and that happened at high schools, at Native American colleges, and at universities. Black Hills State, I believe, was able to take advantage of some things. No, we're not at the level of savings that our counterparts are. South Dakota was the last state to join the compact. Illinois saved on computer purchases for the whole state system. That was in the millions, multi-million dollar savings in contract alone. One thing that they're looking at right now is a way that the compact can assist not only higher ed, but also K through 12 on the pickup and handling of hazardous waste. If you have a chemistry department within your school system, when you mix chemicals, what do you do with what's left over? I didn't hear that. Thank you. Because that is against the law to do as you're suggesting. It's costing South Dakota State University, just one of the universities, on their own, close to $1 million to dispose of that waste. If we can be part of the total compact, there's a huge savings that we could look at. Those are just some of the benefits that we're just getting into. And I stand by for questions.
Representative Abdullah.
I have two questions. If I understand you right, we're 9 months in arrears of the $95,000. We're not.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, please. Because last year we paid at the end of June, that was for this current year. If we pay now, we'll be current.
Okay.
If we wait until after session, then we'll be 9 months behind.
All right. So the money is due now. And if I understand the other part of that, in 2009, the legislature obligated the state up until 2012 to pay these membership dues for 2 years. Beyond when the session, when the legislature voted, they voted to belong for two more years, and that was part of the contract.
Go ahead.
If I may answer the question, we would have to pass a bill as a legislature body signed by the governor saying we no longer want to be part of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. We have 2 years from the date that bill is signed that we have to stay in. It's an enactment that was done in every state. So, and it was passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm correct, too, isn't there a big tuition break for our citizens of South Dakota? So we can not, if this is correct, we don't only have to look at our budget, but just think about students that are already in the pipeline, students who are planning to go to a member state and get a reduced tuition. We have to think of this as a big thing for the positive of the citizens of South Dakota, in addition to necessarily our own fiscal issues.
Senator,
is that correct?
That is correct.
Can you expound on, which universities and what the size of the tuition break is, for example?
I want a list of the students that have taken advantage of that. Zero.
Senator Tiedemann, would you like to jump in here?
I cannot give you the exact number. I mean, I'm relying totally on memory, but it is not zero.
It is one.
It could be less than 100 and more than one.
Okay. Senator Maher.
Two questions. First question is, aren't there some other memberships that the regents are already involved with? I thought there was two other ones out there. And the second question is why isn't this part of the regents' budget?
Good question. Senator Keenan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and excellent questions. Yes, the Board of Regents belongs to a higher ed group called WICHE. That's the Western States. That's going west. And they belonged to that before Midwestern Higher Education Compact was formed. Now, remember, that's the one that the Board of Regents belongs to. Midwest Higher Education Compact, the state belongs to, not the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents serve as one member. The executive director is the one that was appointed by the governor. No, to Midwestern Higher Education Compact. The governor appoints, the legislature appoints two, one from the tech school and one from the Department of Education, that as per statute. So does that answer your question, Senator Maher? But this is separate. Yes, higher ed is involved in it. The uniqueness of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact is that it is not run by higher ed. The chairs, the vice chair, and the secretaries are either a senator or a representative from the member states.
Mr. Chairman, is it because it's not in the region's budget because it's for everything, or because you've got the tech schools involved, the tribal schools, so on and so forth? Is that why?
Please.
And when the bill was drafted, it was specifically identified that this would come out of the governor's budget, and the money was put in there to cover it. And it was done because it's broader than just the Board of Regents. And they were already involved with the WICHE.
For the question, yes, Representative Benner.
I suppose this is a question and a comment. Question would be if we got a copy of their budget. If you said 12 states, $95,000, that's a $1.1 million budget. I'd like to see that budget. I mean, when money starts going into piles like that, and then it's just a board that makes the decisions, I'd like to see a copy of that budget. And just a comment. I apologize for flippantly saying down the drain, and I'm sure it does happen. But I'm a little disgusted when we have, you know, right hand, left hand things going on, and our university system is in the process of eliminating the extension service system within this state. And within that system, as a farmer, that's who I eliminate my chemicals through. They've got a program already set up. So it kind of makes me disgusted that now we've got this board in the sky that's going to help schools eliminate chemical problems. We've already got a way to do it. There's already a mechanism in the state, and our university system's in the process of eliminating it. So it just kind of throws up some red flags and some questions to me. Thank you.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments about extension. I worked for them for 33 years, so yes, it's touched my heart as well. There is a difference. What you're talking about are waste pesticides, and that's a program that is run with Department of Ag and Extension and collection thereof. When you're dealing with the chemicals like sulfuric acid and those things within a chemistry lab and combinations that get put together, that's a different hazardous waste. It's not a waste pesticide, it's a hazardous waste, because you no longer can identify that this is what it is. The Sky and the Board membership is composed of legislators just like us from the other 11 states. The decisions are made by as conservative folks as what you and I are, number two. The budget, yes, it's $95,000 times the 12 states, plus they solicit grants and bring those dollars in. One of the things that they did right after the shooting on the Virginia Tech campus was to do a survey of universities within the 12 states to see what policies were out there. How do you get a hold of students their landlines are no longer used. So how do you get a hold of and get their cell phone numbers? So it very quick acting, a valuable response that was printed. I can't give you their total budget. It's probably somewhere between $3 and $5 million, depending upon the number and size of the grants that come in. It's a very small staff. Dr. Larry Isaacs is the current CEO of the group. He was in the North Dakota higher ed system before he was hired to do the work at MEC. They have then different people that work on various aspects that relate to higher ed, tech schools, and K through 12.
Representative Abdullah.
If this bill was enacted, or when it was enacted in 2009 or 8 or whenever, and the money was to come out of the governor's budget, and we're strapped with a contract for two more years, what are we discussing here? What options do we have? If, according to what Senator Tiedemann says, we're stuck on the contract, then why are we even discussing this, and why isn't the governor paying it out of his budget? That's the way it was agreed to.
Senator Tiedemann.
A year ago when the budget was put forth, that was one of the things that he cut out of the budget.
That's nice.
I know. So it becomes a legislative responsibility because E-Board appointed them. Now, like I said, there's two options. We can spend money that we currently have. It's going to be reverted. Yes, it'll help balance the budget. And then, or we can come back in next session, vote on it, discuss it. We'll be behind, and we have to worry about finding $95,000 because we're obligated to pay the bill.
I have one other option, Mr. Chairman. The Attorney General can try and get us out of the contract because we're not talking about $95,000. We're talking about at least close to $300,000, even if the legislature passes a bill next year to get out of it. We're in it for this year, and then if you pass the bill next year, you got two more years. I'd rather have the Attorney General say we're not paying it.
Representative Lucas.
Well, I would suggest a legislative option. I think this is something that needs more input than this committee. However, we want to approach it, whether we want to go back to the governor and negotiate, whether we want to look at the money, whether we want to get out of it. Quite frankly, it does look to me, just thinking, it could be set up somewhat as a user fee, since so many other are involved besides our state regional universities, and it may be that they would agree to doing something like that. But as I said, those players aren't in the room right now.
Representative Consett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tiedemann, how long have we been in this contract?
The bill was passed in 2008.
2008. So correct me if I'm wrong. We've known that this was coming due in June since 2008, June of every year, that we would have to go back into, I guess, pay our bill for the next fiscal year. I'm on board with what you're trying to accomplish, and the fact that this has been put into place irregardless of any of us being in favor of it. But what I'm uncomfortable with is the lack of information that I have in front of me that will allow me to support what's going on.
Representative Carson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, am I understanding you correctly when you say that once we notify them, we're still on the hook for 2 years?
Please.
Mr. Chair, yes, the only way we can negate the contract is to pass a bill that says we no longer want to be a member of Midwestern Higher Education Compact. I mean, those are the statutes that were passed. That's what we have to live by. And so remember, I'm only the messenger coming from appropriations. I am not the lightning rod here, folks. I'm delivering the message as was passed by them. And I said I would do that. I'm no longer a member of Midwestern Higher Education Compact as an alternate. But I do see some huge benefits coming to the state if we give it the chance to work. And yes, Mr. Chair, if I may,
please continue.
The real time to make that long-term decision is this coming session. But we still owe the bill right now. It did go through the process. It was brought before the committees in education and in appropriations on both sides of the hall and signed by the governor.
Representative Roush.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Tiedemann is correct. We went through the whole process. I was on appropriations at the time, and when they approached us about the concept of joining and the opportunities for savings and all of that was included. And I appreciate the fact that some of our memories, or maybe that time period, some of us weren't here, and so we have forgotten or never did get the information. So, we can get that. We can go back and look at some of the testimony. We can go back and look at who supported it. Representative Dalla may have been like myself and supported it, but we'd have to go back and look at it because at the time it made sense. Do we need to reevaluate it? I think we're foolish if we don't with those kind of membership fees on a regular basis, and we probably need to do that. But it is something that's due. That we have agreed to. I don't know what waiting would do other than you'd maybe get more disappointed in having to pay it later because now it's in the rears instead of paying it in advance. So I'm not opposed to paying our share, but I do think it's something we need to revisit, get the information back out, and have them pitch it again as to why to maintain our membership. In the meantime, we can still talk to the Attorney General and see what our options are. I think all of those are fine to put on the table to help us make a decision, but at this point I look at it as something that we are obligated to do, and I don't know that waiting is going to change that portion of it.
Representative Abdallah.
One last thing. What Representative Roush said, talking to the Attorney General, in my personal opinion, they aren't going to sue us with 11 other states paying them $95,000 a year. They aren't going to make that eyesore. Secondly, if I understand Senator Tiedemann right, if we pass this bill in the 2011 session, we're not off the hook until 2013. Am I correct?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, well, we'd have to pass it in the 2012 session. And so we would be going to 2014.
And nobody in the last half hour has told me any benefits we've received since 2008. And if they did, I missed them.
Representative Conson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Director Fry. If we've been in this compact or this contract with this group since 2008, was this included in the budget?
Director Fry.
Right, this was never included in our budget. We had money to revert last year, and that money was tapped, and it was always in the governor's budget. This was an executive branch obligation, not a legislative branch obligation.
Any other questions or comments in regard to the Midwestern Higher Education contract?
Just one last question. How can a contractual obligation be cut from a budget in the appropriations process? That's the only part I don't understand.
Would one of the appropriators?
I mean, that should be that. Either way, regardless of who pays it, it should go back to the governor's office. It's in statute, and I agree with Abdallah. That's the ball's in his court, not ours. It's a contractual obligation. It comes back on him.
Senator Tiedemann, do you wish to speak?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It was in the governor's budget. Just like the secretaries, when they came forward with their budgets, the governor cut it. You know, we argued over what was the right thing to cut, they were in control of their budgets when they came forward. And so it was put forth as a cut. The legislative branch did not do the due diligence. And as vice chair of appropriations, I'll take the heat. You know, we had other things to think about, and it slipped by us. You know, we're human. But that does not take away the fact that we, the legislature, and South Dakota, owed the bill.
So what you're saying is the governor, in an effort to cut his budget 10%, chose the Midwestern Higher Education contract of $95,000 as one of the cuts. Assuming that they knew that this was a contract, and I'm assuming that they figured somebody else would pick it up. Would that be a fair assumption?
Mr. Chair, you know what they say when you assume anything, and what it is that it was 2 years ago that it was cut from the governor's budget, not this.
Okay.
So
all
it
right,
was one
you.
Session ago, so it was done under Governor Round's administration when we went through all of those huge cuts. And it was at that time, you know, they didn't look at the law saying that we have a two-year obligation.
All right.
But we passed the law. He signed it.
So we are now, after 20 minutes, does anyone have a motion to make in regard to the Midwestern Higher Education contract?
Chairman,
Representative Abdallah.
I move we not pay it and take the consequences as they come.
Second.
We have a motion by Abdallah, seconded by Representative Lucas.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tiedemann.
I offer a substitute motion.
State your motion.
I move that we do pay it out of the dollars that would be reverted from the Legislative Research Council.
Is there a second?
Second.
I would. We have a motion. We have a substitute motion and a second to pay the $95,000. Any further comments before we call for a vote?
Remember this: if you vote to pay this $95,000. You're going to be paying for it until 2014.
Further comments? Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Is there any way, since we are reaching into our otherwise funds to be reverted, that we can go back to some of the direct beneficiaries, i.e. the governor's office, regents, tech schools, and say, hey, you know, we pulled you out of this one, or does it really matter? I mean, it's the money going out the state's coffers, but who does it look on? Who does it reflect on? And can't be done, or does it have to be done in 3 days? Or
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I agree with Speaker Roush that this is an issue that probably we need to review in the next legislative session. I think there probably is a fair argument to be made that this is a good arrangement for South Dakota. At least I think it needs to be debated, but I think we as a legislature freely entered into this agreement. I don't think we've been defrauded or been a victim of misrepresentation in the entering into the agreement, and so I think we have an obligation. I like to follow through on my obligations or the obligations at the body that I'm a part of, and so I'll be in support of paying this bill. Thank you.
Senator Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have often passed bills that we look back and regret or think should be in a different form. We have a procedure for that. We bring up a bill, we go back and amend the law as it sits in the books, and I will be glad to talk with anyone and be interested in what that change might look like. But as of today, if we're going to follow the laws that we pass, we have no object. There is no way out of this. We have to pay our bills. I think there is no other way.
Senator Abdallah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two other things I'll remind you of. Senator Maher is right. This isn't our obligation. That's an obligation of the governor. The governor's office agreed to pay it and just dumped the ball. Secondly, I brought it up before, There isn't one person in this room in 3 years from 2008 to 2011 has told me what advantages we've gotten for paying $285,000 in the last 3 years. What advantages have we got? And so you add, you compound that onto four more years, $700,000. We got to get a lot of benefit from it for paying out $750,000. This thing has got to die. Let the Attorney General let him sue us, and I'll guarantee you we'll win.
Further comments?
I was just going to make one last comment.
Senator Maher.
I'm not disagreeing with that we don't owe the bill. I just think it should be coming out of the governor's office budget.
All right. Seeing no further comments, we have a substitute motion to pay the $95,000 that we are that we are being billed for to the Midwestern Higher Education contract. All those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Gray, Hunstad,
aye.
Maher,
no.
Nelson,
aye.
Lakitamine,
aye.
Thiessen,
aye.
Representatives Abdallah,
no.
Carson,
no.
Consett,
no.
Feinstein,
aye.
Lucas,
no.
Rausch,
aye.
Benner,
no.
Cutler and Chair Turgeville,
aye.
7 ayes, 6 nay.
Motion passes. I would suggest after the, you know, this has been very controversial, and during the next session, I would hope that someone would come to the legislature with an explanation of what the benefits are, or whether, you know, a list that says that this is what we have received for this $95,000.
Mr. Chairman.
And if you feel strong enough about it, then bring a bill with you that will negate the contract. But, you know, I have to agree. This was a close vote. There was a lot of good discussion. But it's a bill that we have to pay, whether or not it was the governor's obligation or not. So it's something we have to, I feel that we should take care of. One last comment, Representative Abdallah.
This vote that was just taken.
I'm sorry?
The vote that was just taken, is that by law a majority of the members elect or the members present?
It's a majority of the members present. Aye. Go ahead and Director Fry.
As it stands, there are no directives in the executive board for what what a majority constitutes. So we normally have always, because the board meets and usually does not have a full complement, we have generally always said the members that are present in the room. So if you have a point of order, I guess you can make that a point of order and we can go look, you know. So.
Do you have a point of order, Representative Abdallah?
No, sir. I just want to remind that this committee that you're going to be paying for the next 4 years.
I understand. All right. We have one last item on the agenda for today. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will be brief because the hour is late. At our meeting in May, we did something that's bothered me a little bit at that point, and the more I visit with people and it comes down the pike, I'd like to visit with it. I'd like to bring it to this board and visit with it briefly and then possibly some action. But we voted to include the Human Services Center with the review of the Department of Human Services. Well, the Human Services Center is no longer under that department. And I thought about it a little bit, but we all voted for it. There wasn't a dissenting vote, so, and I don't know that we discussed it quite enough. But there is the Behavioral Health Committee, which is looking at the Human Services Center, and I think perhaps the Human Services Center should be reviewed when the Department of Social Services is reviewed and not in a department that's no longer there. In addition to that, the director has resigned a couple of weeks ago. He's going on to Arizona, and you know, we're a little bit behind the eight ball because of flooding and what have you. Our committees have all been moved back. I think that we're overloading some things, and if we continue down this road with the agency review and have the department, the Human Services Center reviewed, we're kind of duplicating some efforts. And so I throw it out for discussion that perhaps this is something we should revert at this time.
Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was, I believe the legislator brought that forth, whether in fact we should include that in there because of the rotation when we did social services agency review. At that time, then, Human Services Center was included with Human Services. Now they've been transferred. So it would kind of be like they're missing out on the review. I think that was our logic for that. Now, the fact that the director at the Human Services Center has left the state and that the fact that we have a new Secretary of Human Services, I think, you know, really begs the issue that we do need to have a thorough review there to see that we do have the right personnel and services in place to take care of some of our most incapable citizens.
Just to revisit that, the Human Services Center is being reviewed by the Behavior Health Committee, and there are several legislators who are on that. So I think we'd be duplicating it. And again, in terms of time and money, you know, it's July. I think that we ought to move on.
If I could ask,
Representative,
what's the Behavior Health Committee? I'm not familiar with that.
It's the governor's appointed committee looking into behavioral health as well as the. It's all part of the Medicaid review. It's part of the big working group that's going on with the governor. So they are reviewing it and looking at it.
Representative Roush.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd agree with Senator Nelson that I think the timing, unfortunately for us, has changed and the urgency to do so. Quite honestly, I don't think the departments could put together the necessary information for us to do an agency review. They are already changing their offices from one location to another underneath a whole different structure and a different boss. They are being evaluated in that whole process, and for us to jump in the middle of that, I'm all for putting it on hold this year, taking a look at the possibility of next year if we want to look at them specifically, but I think the timing right now, with everything that's going on, I think it's especially in periods where they would have to come and meet. I just think the timing is a very unfortunate, and I don't know that we would have as good a review if we did it now as if we waited until everything settled down and let them get settled within their new assignments.
Further comments? Senator Thiessen.
Thank you. Question for somebody that knows. Anybody on this committee serve on that? Who does serve on from the legislature on that committee, which I can't remember the name of right now?
Senator Nelson.
The Behavior Health Committee, Representative Gibson, Senator Krause, and Representative Mosier are the three legislative appointments to that committee. And there's
Thank you.
The rest of them as well. You can pass them now.
Any other comments? Senator Nelson, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we remove the Human Services Center from the agency review for the Department of Human Services.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Seconded from Representative Roush. Any further comments? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Different.
Let the record reflect Representative Lucas was the lone no vote. Motion carried. Is there anything else to bring before this committee at this time? We've had a long and very successful day. One comment I'd like to make before we adjourn. you know, there's always there was questions at the beginning of the session about the funding that we were going to be looking at for LRC. You know, and we are one of the few departments, I think, that are going to be reverting money after we've made the cuts. You know, just for the record, I'd like it, you know, known that I think that this committee and Director Fry and his staff have done an excellent job to be able to revert that much money. And it's a fortunate thing that we had that kind of money to revert. Otherwise, we would not have been able to make this payment to the Midwestern Higher Education Contract. With that, hearing nothing further, entertain a motion.
I move we adjourn.
Second. We have a motion to adjourn and second. All in favor say aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Thank you.
Abdallah, you voted for that thing. No, I agree, but let's have them come in and show us what they've saved us.
He's got it right here.
What? It's a wash. Go to the Midwest.
It's a wash. $190,000, according to them, that they've saved us since we belonged.
Sweet.
Yeah, and we paid them $300,000.
That's a bargain, isn't it?